Good morning, everyone. We have a busy morning ahead of us, and I will call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and we'll start with Representative Hanson still. He's somewhere. Okay. And then just talk about what we're going to do after we hear that bill. And I understand there may be some people here who want to testify about that bill. So we will make sure we have an opportunity for folks to talk. Then we are going to have a report from the Pollution Control Agency on the outcomes from their current budget. So that will be this the biennium that we're in. That may not all get done today or this morning. So we will recess and finish it up tonight. Then on Tuesday, we will hear from PCA for the governor's budget, including proposals for the new dollars. And we're going to ask them if they would be very clear about the outcome for water in the new budget proposal. So that is what we have, but we don't seem to have a Representative Hanson. So, but we will do some minutes. Representative Purcell, would you move the minutes of February 3rd?
I move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And of February 5th?
Of February 5th.
Okay. Representative Purcell has moved to adopt the minutes of February 3rd and February 5th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are adopted. Representative Hanson, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you would like to bring up some folks from the Heritage Council, I think that should make matters go a little faster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do I need to renew my motion to bring House File 18 as amended onto the floor?
Please do that. That will clarify for the record.
I would renew my motion to recommend to pass House File 18 as amended with the DE3 amendment last week, to pass and be recommended to finance to go to the Cultural and Outdoor Committee chaired by Mary Murphy.
Right. I think that is the same motion we had on the table when we left last week, and the members understand the motion. Okay. With that, I think we know where we are. We were, Mr. Kilgore, Professor Kilgore, do you want to come down and join with Representative Hanson? And just before we start with this particular part of the bill, we were having a conversation when we left about the public notice of the Heritage Council. And I think I was left with the impression that that if someone went up on the website, they would understand exactly what was going on right now. And so I went up on the website and looked at it, and all I saw was that there were four meetings of the Heritage Council were put up on the website, and yet I know there are other meetings going on. So I looked at your what you had in your proposal, and it said there, if I can find it, it said that you were going to request conservation stakeholders to convene a process for identifying conservation and habitat investment priorities. And as I understand it, those meetings are going on, but there was no notice on your website of where these meetings were or how people could join in. Help me out here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Kilgore. I am the chair of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. Yes, the website that you're referring to is our website, and the document you're looking at is a five-page document the council approved. If you look at the website, Madam Chair, I don't have it in front of me, but the key is there's a contact for the DNR staff person who is coordinating, acting as a staff person for the Outdoor Heritage Council to get more information. And so the process document you referred to lays out our criteria for what we consider to be eligible projects, the schedule of our meetings, which were laid out in that document, two in February. We had one yesterday, one in 2 weeks, two in March, and then the contact information for folks to get more information on how to participate. And just, if I may, Madam Chair, just tell you a little bit about the meeting we had yesterday, which was the first of two meetings that the council had to receive proposals. And as part of that process, we asked folks to come together and work collaboratively to develop proposals in the areas of prairies, wetlands, forests, and fish and game habitat. Yesterday we heard the prairie and the wetland proposals. In fact, we heard proposals from over $100 million worth of investments. But I think more importantly to the council, we didn't hear just the collaborative proposals. We had a couple of other proposals that came in on their own, as I mentioned last week. We certainly don't tell folks or discourage them from submitting their own proposals to the council. We would like them to work with other groups to try and sift through these projects and try to identify those highest conservation needs for us, but we didn't tell them that if they didn't participate in that process, they weren't eligible to provide a proposal to us.
I think we're missing a point here. The point is that there is a process that's going on, but the general public doesn't know what's going on, and they don't have a way of knowing that it's going on. Because you don't post notice of it. Did each of these groups then post a notice that was, in your proposal you also say everything can be transparent. So, even if they posted a notice on the internet, I don't know how folks in Minnesota would know to look for these, because I didn't see on your website any applications, request for proposal. And I bring this up because this money belongs to the people of Minnesota, and they should be able to participate in the process of requesting.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and just to give you a sense of at least how the wetland collaborative proposal reached out to individuals. I asked the person, Ryan Heiniger, who coordinated that, to just give me a sense of beyond our website, what they did to help solicit input from interested parties. Okay, just to let you know about them reaching out on our behalf.
Okay, but if it's on your behalf, why didn't you have it on your website? That's my basic question here.
Madam Chair, we did list on our website all the meetings and all the contact information for anyone who wanted to participate. I'm not sure what else to tell you other than that we've only been meeting, this is our fifth meeting. You know, we obviously are trying our best as citizens. These are eight citizens. We have a number of them in the crowd today that are trying to do the work that you asked us to do, trying to meet the deadline of April 1 with the bill. And we're certainly welcome, open to suggestions, but we are just getting up and running, and we're trying to reach out as best we can. We have put out news releases. And if I may, Madam Chair, just to let you know how at least one process tried to reach out. This is the wetland process. They distributed the announcement of their process to over 700 individuals on a listserv. In addition, we have a listserv that for the Bussard Outdoor Heritage Council that is several hundred people. That was also sent out. They asked all the people who are participating, being the Department of Natural Resources, Board of Water and Soil Resources, to reach out as well and publicize that. There was publicity in in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. So, you know, obviously we could have done more, but given the fact that we just got up and running and really haven't started doing any meaningful work until last month, we're certainly going to have people who would say we should do more, and we'll certainly try, and we'd welcome any opportunities to do that.
Well, I look at the website, I see no applications, I see no request for proposal, and so if I were just a member of the public,
I would think that there was nothing going on yet. And so here's the basic question. What's going on, as someone who's just observing it and not a participant in it, it seems that your process for gathering information is being done by those who want the funds for their own projects and for their own organizations, and that the general public doesn't know what's going on. And so I think that's a real issue for public dollars. So I don't think there's anything more to be said about that. That's what's going on. So I think we will ask Representative Gunter if he has a question.
I have a question. I think I have more of a statement. Chairman Kilgore, isn't it true that the DNR said that they advertise what we're doing the same way they do other things that they advertise for the DNR?
That's correct. Madam Chair and Representative Gunther, that's correct.
So if the DNR, if we're ineffective in doing it, so is the DNR.
Well, then that doesn't say a whole bunch about the DNR, does it?
You've been in charge of them.
Well, mm-hmm. Oh, I wish I was. Did you have a question?
To this point.
Yes, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I did attend a good part of the council's meeting yesterday. Senator Anderson raised questions along the same line that you did, and the council made the decision during the meeting to allow people to still weigh in on the process, if I remember right, that they were open to, they were concerned about the possibility that we have laid out such an aggressive time schedule that there may be people that didn't know that they needed to be on board right now, and they laid out an opportunity for at a later meeting to bring proposals forward. So I believe, Madam Chair, that there may be folks in the public that are paying attention to what we're doing that may not realize that if you have gone to the website, and I think it could be more informative, but maybe there's folks that are listening that need to know that there is still an opportunity to weigh in on this very fast schedule.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kilgore. This is somewhat of a question, but some background. Last night in my district, I had a meeting with about 35 people with the Friends of the Mississippi River and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and there was significant interest in how this money was going to be used and making sure it was used in the right way, and a few people who wanted to figure out how they could apply for grant money or what have you. But there was, I think, the overarching message is this needs to be used in the right way and it needs to be done in the right way. And I think my biggest concern is that there's the public buy-in to this process, that we're doing it and having it be effective. And there's also legislator buy-in and making sure legislators who ultimately have to appropriate money were part of the process with the Citizen Council and are able to attend those meetings even as they have their legislative duties. And then also making sure that how well this process is done, and there's different folks who are commenting on the prices who have probably bigger bully pulpits just by virtue of what they do. And so I'm interested in hearing your comments on how we get that public and legislator buy-in. I think they're both extremely important to this process working, and I want it to be successful. I think passing the amendment was a huge success, and we need to build on that moving forward.
Madam Chair and Representative, we share your concern. We certainly want this to be a process that when we come up with our recommendations in less than about a month and a half, that the public will say, yes, that does meet the intended mission of that Outdoor Heritage Fund of protecting, enhancing, and restoring prairies, wetlands, and forests. And so I can just tell you that, the commitment to these people that are serving on this council, all 12 members, is extraordinary. I really believe that. I mean, we spent, as Representative McNamara can attest, he was there for a good part of yesterday's meeting, 8.5 hours of going through proposals. Many of these members don't live in the metropolitan area, and making a substantial commitment of time, spending time over the weekend reviewing $100 million worth of proposals. So the buy-in of the public is obviously in what we recommend and whether the public thinks that the dollars that they're going to be, that they supported to commit to are going to be used for the right purposes. But I do believe the process we put in place, and in particular the dedication of the members, the citizens and legislators, is going to produce a product that the citizens will say, yes, that's where we want to invest our money for habitat.
I think you expressed it well, how we feel about what's going on. Representative Selfie.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Kilgore, I think the question is coming up because of the news reports. We're reading so many news articles regarding this issue, and I'm certainly hearing about it from people in my district. And the question is that has been reported is the hiring of an executive director. Is that, in fact, the case?
Madam Chair, we are not hiring an executive director. We have right now a staff person, Bill Becker, from the Department of Natural Resources, who is serving as, if you want to call it, executive director. He's the staff person that's coordinating our work. What this bill that's in front of you would do would provide the transfer of that administrative authority over to the legislative body, since we are a legislative body. And to be quite honest, the criticism that we hear at almost every meeting is the fact that the Department of Natural Resources, who is administering us, is also coming to us for money, and there needs to be greater arm's length distance between that department, who might be the recipient of Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars, and their administration of the Outdoor Heritage Council. But we have one person right now. We have a temporary person who helps Bill out at meetings to take meeting notes and help coordinate the meeting, but that's all we have. We have no plans to move forward. We have no budget for that.
As a follow-up, thank you, Ms. Chair. It's just the whole process is just a little strange to the person out on the street, because as I understand it, you were required to begin meeting December 1st, and you have to have this proposal by April 1st. I could be wrong on those dates, but
no, that's correct.
That's what I've been reading, and but to have no money, and you know, the comment was made here last week. You have no money. So what I don't understand is, how can we require you to meet by December 1st, have a proposal by April 1st, when you have no money? We're requiring people to travel. We're requiring people to stay and from out of town. I mean, we have, I don't know where all the members are from. I don't know their exact locations. But if we're requiring people to travel and do this work and we have no money, the DNR does not have staff just sitting around doing nothing. Somebody's got to make sure that there's money for what we have to do. In effect, it would have been a better idea to have this process moving later when we have the money. But since it's been set in law that it moves now, we have to figure out some way to fund the activities of the council without going into hiring an executive director and getting a whole bureaucracy. And that's what the people on the street are thinking.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, that's why we are here today, and that's why we have House File 18. And I think it's important to be clear on what we're doing. This is really an operating loan because the money, the sales tax revenue, does not start being collected until July 1st. And so the bill in front of you, as amended, takes into account that, yes, the DNR, doing as they were directed to do, has been expending time and energy on preparing for that December 1st meeting, and then following up after the meeting, preparing for the next meeting, doing the communications, getting the website set up, preparing for additional meetings, getting the minutes done. All that work is being done, as we directed them to do in statute. What we're doing in the bill is an operating loan. We're taking revenue from another fund to be paid back. So we're not using general fund dollars. We're not using dollars that we don't have. We're taking existing small D dedicated dollars, using them right now so that we are making sure the expenditures are clean and clear for the DNR and for the council members who are traveling in at some distance and staying at the Kelly Inn the night before the meeting. So you have expenditures that are occurring for that participation. The bill that's in front of you recognizes that. I think that it's important for us to act as the legislature to pass the bill so that we are clear and transparent and the legislature is appropriating money. bill that authorized the council didn't appropriate money. The constitutional amendment hadn't passed yet. So it passed. The law kicks in. And I believe now, as rather than waiting through the regular appropriation process, we have activities going on that we should have a clear light of day where the legislature votes to provide for those expenditures.
Let me recognize Representative Bill right now. I believe you have an amendment, Representative Bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Has the amendment been distributed?
I think it's
Could we maybe let people digest this for a couple of minutes, is it possible, and then go, or do you want me to just explain it right off the bat?
You can explain it, because I think he explained what the bill does is applying to it, and then before we vote on it, I will make sure everybody has an opportunity to weigh in. I do have a list of folks that would like to weigh in.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the 18A1 amendment.
Representative Gill has moved the 18A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, we've had a lot of discussion on this bill already, and a lot of discussion in other settings around both buildings. And so the crux of the amendment, it defines the amendment, the delete all amendment that was adopted, it would define that the expenses to be paid from this appropriation are the only eligible expenses paid from this appropriation would be office expenses of the department, per diem, mileage, and lodging. Now, that doesn't mean this is, and also this bill is available, this appropriation would be available until July 1. And so from July 1 on, that would leave another committee and another group of legislators working with the council to define how that's going to look in beyond July 1. So this is kind of this bill is a bridge, and this kind of defines the bridge where the sideboards are. It also says that the council's website, in full disclosure, will have the expenditures that are made from this appropriation available on their website. And just as with legislators and others, our per diem lodging, housing, committee meetings, all of that are public information and can be requested by anyone, and they receive great detail with that. And so those are the three areas that are covered by this amendment, and I'll stand for any questions.
Members, I have seen some folks on the list after Representative Gill. Would you like to go ahead, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually a question to the amendment, Representative Gill. What happens to any remaining funds if they're not used?
They would be unused, and it says in the bill that the money is transferred from the water recreation account, and then later in the bill it says the amount necessary to make transfer is appropriated. The transfer of funds must be completed before any other funds are expended by the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So the money would be whatever amount ends up, $150 at the present time, would be transferred in, and any unused amount would be transferred out. Back into the water recreation. The full amount would be repaid, the whole $150, and then the money that was expended would be made up when the actual appropriation or the actual next bill is passed, and the money starts flowing.
Okay. Madam Chair, I do have other questions, but I didn't know if you wanted to give an opportunity for members to ask questions about his amendment before we go.
Let's have a few more questions about the amendment, if there are questions, and then we'll come back to you. But I don't, Representative Packforth, to the amendment? Or?
Yes, Madam Chair. Well, it's to the amendment and to the bill as it's amended. Madam Chair, we were talking about this last week, and I was hoping to get in a little bit more discussion about the bill itself, discussing the bill before we got to amendments. So as long as we're on the amendment, Representative Dale, I'm wondering, we heard discussion last week from the DNR that the commissioner, by executive order or whatever means it was, he set aside $100,000 for the council to do their work. We heard that testimony, and I don't hear any of that here today. Why aren't we talking about that? Any amendment that we should be talking about on this bill should be talking about paying that money back. The commissioner set aside $100,000 to get this council up and running. Why isn't that being talked about? We've heard about that testimony from the DNR. Any kind of an amendment that we should be talking about here today should be talking about paying that money back to the Game and Fish Fund. And that's the end of the story. Why are we getting into these kind of details? Here we are with an amendment that's taking money out of a dedicated account. I think that alone sets a nasty precedent. Why are we taking money from a dedicated fund to get this thing up and running? That shouldn't be happening to start with. So, Madam Chair, I think we should have been looking at some other issues with this bill before we got into this amendment. I like the amendment for this bill, but I don't think this is the bill we should be going forward with. We should be talking about the money that was set aside by the commissioner to get council up and running. I mean, it's done. It's taken care of. Now, why aren't we just doing an amendment that says, this is how we're going to put the money back, and this is when it's going to be paid back for what the commissioner set aside?
Well, I'm not speaking directly to the amendment, Madam Chair, but I do have some comments I'd like to make on the bill in general. As you know, I've been serving on the Clean Water Council, which was created 2 years ago. The language creating the council states the Pollution Control Agency shall provide administrative support for the council, and we've been operating fine for 2 years under that language. PCA has been taking care of us without hiring extra staff or requiring any legislation. The language is almost identical to the language that creates this council. Only the DNR is there instead of the PCA. I don't know why we're even considering this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kilgore, last week when we had a conversation on this bill, I had asked that we have a detailing of what this money is going to be going towards. I was hoping that I would see it here today. Did you have a chance to bring it with you today, and do you have copies for all the members?
Madam Chair and Representative, I asked our Executive Director, Bill Becker, to get that information. We don't have that. I don't have that in front of me. I don't deal with the expenses of the council, but I've asked them to put that information together.
Great. Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Kilgore. I don't feel comfortable in moving forward with this without knowing what it is that this money is going towards. It would be irresponsible. We're not just a pass-through agency. I think the public could have asked us to be more diligent in our work. And so I really feel that before we even move forward, we need to know where this money is going to be going.
Sure. And Madam Chair, if I may just describe, so right now, and I guess I would certainly defer to the Department of Natural Resources for detail, but right now the Department of Natural Resources, my understanding, they are cost-coding Bill Becker's and any other staff time, including website development, administrative support, to this activity. This transfer of funds would simply be a transfer of that money to the LCC. Then that money could be used to continue to pay Mr. Becker and any other staff support related to it. In addition, it would be the cost of reimbursing the council members for traveling in, paying their mileage, if they have to incur a hotel cost or any meals, it would be to cover that. I don't anticipate it would cover anything beyond those two items, just the administrative support for the council and to cover the reimbursement expenses of the citizen members.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Mr. Kilgore, I realize that I don't mean to put you on the spot. I know that I had made that request for the Department of Natural Resources last week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that I assumed that it would not be a difficult task to do, because I'm assuming that they had to do that in order to come up with the $150,000 number in the first place, because otherwise I don't know what they based that estimate on. So I guess, like I said, I look forward to seeing the detail of how that money will be spent and what it's based on.
Madam Chair, just maybe back to the amendment and trying to get some information from Representative Dill. With your A1 amendment, is this what your intent here is to make this reimbursement, so it's clear that it's reimbursement of actual expenses? And with the web page, you are saying that, you know, if Bill Becker in the month of February, his salary and cost is $20,000, that's reimbursed, and then that goes in. If one of the council members drives in 200 miles and they stay at the Kelly Inn and they fill out a form that that's what's reimbursed. So you're, what, are you, what is what you're trying to do here, reimbursement of actual expenses?
That's correct. It says on line 1.10 of the amendment, it says that the this section must be made available in detail. And that is what I mean by in detail. And so the public can understand, just as with legislators or other members that receive that those kinds of reimbursements, the people can see what it takes to make this thing work.
And to follow up and with Representative Anderson, with any council members' expenses, with this being a legislative council, it would require, as does the LCCMR, a legislator approving that travel. So it would not be Mr. Kilgore, it would not be DNR staff. It would be an elected person that will have to sign, will review that and sign off on that travel, and their signature would be on that form, and that would go up on the website. Is that correct, Mr. Bill? Representative Bill?
I don't think, Madam Chair, that the form would go up on the website that you signed, but the information pertinent to the request for reimbursement would be, so you maybe would have a member, it might say, so much lodging, so much, and it, in my estimation, like ours, you have the detail and then you have the aggregate of each of those groups of expenses. And frankly, I mean, it says in detail, so I'm willing to let whoever is administering this figure out what in detail means, but I think the intent is to kind of mimic what happens with other public officials.
I think that's right. Any other comment, Representative Hansen?
Just back on the purpose of this, Madam Chair, the legislature appropriates funds. We're doing this so that the legislature is taking a vote. Members can vote up or down, representing their districts on how they feel on this, but I think it's important for transparency that it's clear that we send money that we have. The bill that was authorized the council did say there was administrative expenses, but it didn't appropriate the dollars for it.
So we have the clarifying amendment. I don't see any other. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think I'd like Mr. Meyer to come up. I have some questions for along Representative Hackbart's train of thought about where we're at so far, where it's been paid from. And then I think Representative Anderson, I did go ahead and get a bunch of the information that you're asking about. So maybe as I ask Mr. Meyer some of his questions, some of your questions will get answered at the same time.
Excuse me for a moment. We are on the amendment. Is this to the amendment or the whole bill? I'm hearing that it's to the whole bill.
This is actually to the amendment, Madam Chair.
Right. Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Representative McNamara, I think we touched on this a little bit last time, but I'm going to start at kind of the beginning. The amendment passed election day in November. We started incurring costs because the council needed to be up and running by December 1st, have a meeting by December 1st, with recommendations by April 1st to the legislature. With that understanding and no appropriation in the conference committee last year, Commissioner Holston sent a letter to Madam Chair, the Chair of the Environment Finance Committee, and several other, I think it went to the Speaker and the Majority Leader in the House and the Senate, clarifying our intent to take $100,000 out of a non-dedicated account within the Game and Fish Fund, actually revenues that'd be used for the ELS system, to borrow $100,000, up to $100,000 out of that account to pay for the costs associated with the council. Until, I think we estimated July 1st of 2009, when we assumed an appropriation would be available for the council. And the letter also stated that it was our intention to be reimbursed for those costs. So with that, we also stated that, I believe in the letter, that we were assigning Bill Becker, who has been our LCCMR liaison for a long time, to the administrative duties of the council. His current duties with the DNR would be transferred to other personnel, so his only function is to provide assistance to the council. And then we also have to provide administrative assistance. The meeting that they had yesterday, one of the commissioner's office executive assistants actually provided the administrative support for that. So that's an all-day affair. We're tracking all of those costs. To date, at the last accounting that I provided information to Representative Hansen and others, and Representative Anderson, I apologize, I don't have that sheet with me today. If I can get you another sheet on where we're at right now, it was for salary time a little bit over $12,000. That included some meetings, parking, at the AA lot, postage and things like that. We haven't paid per diem yet. We're still reviewing the per diem, and if we need to have a legislator or Representative Hanson who feels he needs to sign off on those appropriations, that's not a problem. The per diem that they are allowed for is in statute in 15.0545 under the commissioner's plan. It's $55 per day, and then meals of, I think, breakfast is $7, lunch is $9, dinner is $15, and then when there is an overnight stay acquired lodging, and, you know, people use their best judgments to trying to find the cheapest available. I mean, people aren't staying at the Hilton or St. Paul Hotel or anything. It's probably at the Kelly Inn or someplace close by, depending on availability. So those costs are all there and accounted for. We've agreed to pay those costs right now. Where Representative Hanson is coming from is the legislation that establishes this council kind of creates a gray area. The council is established within the legislative branch, but it requires the executive branch to provide support for it. So there's requirements for the open meeting law and things of that nature being within the legislative branch, but the DNR has been pulled in from the executive side to provide administrative support. The bill doesn't change that. Mr. Kilgore stated that the bill takes the DNR out of that picture. It does not. It would still require the DNR to provide that administrative support. And the way I understand it, should this bill pass, we will transfer $150,000 from the Water Recreation account to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and then we would bill them for the time that we need to be reimbursed for rather than take it out of our account. So the cost would be actually paid for out of the legislative branch, which probably by statute is the way it should be, because, again, we're working in kind of this gray area. So all the costs that we've paid for, and we haven't paid the per diem yet, we're still reviewing that, making sure it's all correct, and we can work with the LCC or whoever people feel comfortable with us doing that, are allowed by statute, and we can certainly put it up on the website. And, Madam Chair, I just want to go back real quickly to the public notice piece. The website does have a listserv, just like the legislature does, and every committee has a listserv. You can put your name on there, and we do public notice it through that, through the statewide news system that we put all of our press releases on. So, Madam Chair, we do feel we are meeting the requirements of public notice, just as the legislature does, with the same system, actually. So, if not, I think the council needs, we need to figure out how to do that better. Maybe work with the papers, or I don't know what else of the requirements are, because we're following the same procedures that the legislature is following for public notice in their hearing.
Regarding the notice, since I was the one that brought up the notice issue, I looked at the groups that are making these packages, these partners groups that are making packages, and there's no notice to the public that these meetings are going on. That's one problem. The second problem is up on the website, there is no process for people to know that these groups are going on, nor is there like an application form or a request for proposal or anything to even give the public a clue that this is going on. So I think there are issues here. I think Representative Munoz put it best. We do want this process to work and be open and transparent, and there are steps that need to be made yet. Let's come back to the amendment. I'm watching the time. We're going to be here very late tonight. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if we need to stay here real late, I think we should. This is important. We need to get to the bottom of this and understand just what we have going on.
I will sit here as long as you do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm trying to understand, or Representative Hanson, you've identified a different, you changed your bill. We got a change in the bill at our last meeting. Originally, I'm assuming you were changing the $100,000 that the commissioner let the chair know about, and you're using a different account. And I'm wondering, is there a reason why the account changed? Maybe I'll try and make my questions real short to accommodate everybody.
That's
the reason why we changed the time.
Representative McNamara, that was at the DNR's request. Originally, the bill, as it was introduced, stated game and fish, and because of that legislative transferring funds from the executive branch to the legislative branch, talking with our federal aid coordinators, they said there may be an issue of a diversion, because we're taking money from the executive branch of government and transferring it to the legislative branch. They're okay with the cost we're incurring to operate the council because there is a direct link to game, fish, and wildlife habitat. But the transferring of those funds from one branch of government to the other is where the match to Pittman Robertson, Wallop Perot. You know, you hear about that also. We try to bring that up whenever those diversion issues come into play. And we contacted our federal aid coordinators. I can give fiscal staff the documentation that clearly outlines that when a diversion occurs. Mr. Reynolds probably has that documentation, actually. So it was at our request, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Anderson, to your point, and Representative Hansen, you can clarify this if I'm wrong. I believe the council has met five times already. It's programmed to meet about five times in March. If we assume it's going to meet once a month after March, so 13 meetings. I came up with Representative Anderson probably about $1,600 between per diem mileage. There's, I think, 691 miles between the eight non-legislative members, and it's $55 a day, as Commissioner Meyer has said. And if four of them are staying overnight and they're staying at the Kelly, it's another $400. When I add it all up, it says, again, and I'll read back to Representative Dill, to the conference committee that we sat on, and put this in. There's only five lines about how this is funded. The DNR shall provide administrative support for the council. Commissioner Meyer, you're doing that. You're doing that just like you're supposed to. You're keeping track of the money like you're supposed to. Because then it says up to 1% of the money, even though we had an amendment on the floor to make that one half, if I remember Representative Hackbart, we were in the interest of cutting it down, and don't be surprised if that amendment shows up again. I think it would be a good amendment to reduce the administration. They want the money on the ground for the projects like you were looking at yesterday. Up to 1% will be appropriated and may be used to cover staff-related administrative expenses of the department and to cover compensation. We're doing all that. You're doing that, Commissioner Meyer. I don't understand, like Representative Hackbart, why we're even here. I think this is about expanding this thing, getting it bigger than what it's already doing. You're operating it like you're supposed to. You got Mr. Becker over there and one support staff taking notes, and they're running this thing with a bunch of citizens and a few legislators, like, though some of us would have liked to have seen it a little different, in a good way. I don't understand why we want to, first thing to come out of the chute here is we're going to increase the administrative expense. Let's run this thing on the skinny like the people that voted for it want it. You're doing it right, Commissioner Meyer, and Representative Anderson wanting to, and Representative Dill wanting transparency. Put it up on there. These guys get $55 a day. I'm sorry, if it's Dr. Kildor or Professor Kildor and Mr. Schroeder can make more than $55 a day doing something else, we're not overpaying them. And if we give them the mileage for coming from Worthington, Perham, or Cologne, I guess, Worthington the farthest, I think that's the right thing. Madam Chair, I don't know why we can accept Representative Bill's amendment, but we should just vote this down and let them run with what they're doing.
I think Representative Bill's amendment is before us, Representative Anderson. No, there's no question. The amendment is before us. I see no other questions. All those in favor of Representative Bill's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. We are on the bill now, and are there questions to the bill itself?
Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
You'd ask for a roll call? All right. We will have a roll call. Representative Hackbar.
Madam Chair, I apologize for not being here in the very beginning, but what was the motion for this bill? Is this bill going to the Finance Committee, or is it going direct to the floor, or what's happening?
It will go to the Finance Committee and then be re-referred to the Committee on Cultural and Outdoor Things.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could maybe respond before the vote.
Yes, you can, but let's get Representative Anzel's question first, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I can vote in an informed way on this, it just seems to me that we need clarity here on the issue of the money, the appropriation. Are there two distinct pots of money being utilized to get the council up and running and performing to meet the deadlines, i.e., is there a $100,000 pot of money within the department in addition to the $150,000 which will come in this transfer situation? I really need clarity on that.
Madam
Chair, it's my understanding this the appropriation would appropriate the $150,000 and the $100,000, if not in addition to.
Thanks.
It is not in addition to.
Representative Johnson.
And this is really confusing, and this sort of goes to Representative Anzalt's comments and also to Representative Torkelson's comments. I mean, if the PCA is doing this for the Clean Water Account and there's no money having to change, then why do we have to change money for this DNR account? I don't get that. If they're doing it anyway without a loan, why do we have to pass this bill? I guess it's coming down to that.
Well, let me help out a little bit there. I think Representative McNamara actually helped us out when he read the language that said, will be appropriated. That's how we did not, in the conference committee, appropriate money. It said we provided this is the limit to the amount you can appropriate, but we did not do any appropriation. So this is the appropriation bill that will be appropriated. The difference with Representative Torkelson is that was part of an appropriations process that already went on. It was just included in our regular bill. So there is the difference there. The legislature did, as it was voting for the PCA bill, know that that work was going to be done by the PCA. So we were aware of that when we voted for that bill. Yes, there's a follow-up, sure.
Well, then, if the $100,000 is appropriated, why do we need to appropriate $150,000 if that's already in the law?
That isn't in the law. Okay, I think Representative Gill would like to respond.
Well, Madam Chair, there isn't any appropriation at this time. There's $100,000 that the Commissioner Holson reserved by some executive order process that I'm really not familiar with to try and cover this. But when this bill is passed, when this appropriation is made, that executive order will become a moot issue, because that was something that was a bridge, and now we're building a better bridge, so to speak. And one other thing I just want to mention about the bill, because of the way we limited it in the amendment, the way the bill now stands before us, I really think that the amount is too much. It could probably be a whole lot less, because we're paying administrative expenses to the department. It's very it's quite defining. And mileage and per diem and lodging, and I think Representative McNamara made a good point. I think you had the numbers that they'd already had, and this only goes till July 1st in the second place. I'm not proposing that we amend it, but I certainly think amend it further, but something that we could consider. I think $150,000 is probably an overkill. But I don't think once this bill is passed, and if it became law, that $100,000 that was made available by the commissioner is any longer a part of this project. And if they spent any of that money, I think that Mr. Meyer said that they had spent part of that money, that would be reimbursed from this presently $150,000 appropriation. And as I recall, Madam Chair, and I think you said, that when we passed the Clean Water Bill with the PCA, that it provided for, we provided the appropriation. I'm trying to remember if we provided it. How did we handle that exactly? You were talking about it.
What
Representative Torkelson was talking about.
When we have passed our general appropriation bill,
we included the money?
Well, it was included. We knew that they would be doing that work. It was not a line item, but we knew they were going to be doing that work.
And so, Madam Chair, so that we then, in theory, we allowed them some additional funds so that we could make sure that they were whole.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
That was just part of the general appropriation. Yes, Representative Torkelson.
Yes. Well, you say that the PCA bill informed the legislature that we knew we'd be doing that work. I don't understand the difference between the two bills then. The same language is used in both bills. Didn't you know the DNR was going to be doing this work?
This is not my bill, but I will go back to what Representative McNamara said. It said, will be appropriated. We have not taken that step, and that is what Representative Hansen is proposing to do, is that appropriation that we didn't make before because the constitutional amendment had not passed yet. So last spring, when we were doing that bill, we didn't make an appropriation because there was no money. There was no constitutional amendment that had passed. So now that the constitutional amendment has passed, Representative Hansen is coming forth and saying we need to remedy what we didn't do last year because we couldn't do it.
Madam Chair,
is that fair to say, Representative Hansen?
Yes, there's an even more distinct point, and that's the Constitution, is that the Clean Water Council is in the executive branch, advisory to the executive branch, and that
yes.
The LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council is a hybrid between the executive branch and the legislative branch. What this bill is doing is clarifying that this is in the legislative branch where the expenditures occur. It states in the statute that this is in the authorizing statute, that this is the legislative branch, but it has also stated that the DNR provides administrative support. House File 18, as amended, provides that appropriation and clearly lays out the process where that will occur. I think to answer some of these questions, I'm going to hand out an email and some information so you're fully informed before you vote. That the reason we're here is the authorization and the ability to conduct business. The council has set up subcommittees. We were prepared to look at personnel decisions in December. The commissioner had drafted what I'm going to hand out. A position description and was prepared to post the position description for hiring under the statutory language of providing administrative support. And if you'll notice on the email with my cover, in conversation with the members of the council, questioning that those basic questions of authority. And the way to provide authority is for the people's representatives, the legislature, to vote for that appropriation. Now, what Representative Dill has done with the amendment that we have adopted is it provides reimbursement for expenses. Mr. Becker and other staff are providing expenses and support for the council. Council members are having expenses. The bill has this, I think those are good amendments. They're refined and it allows us to continue to operate business. It's actually less than the $800,000. And Representative Dill, I'd be happy with going in inserting the words up to, so it's clear that it's not going to be a large blank check. It's not. It's for reimbursement from what I understand you've just done. So this clarifies that it's through the Legislative Coordinating Commission and that the appropriation is there. It's a bridge to carry us through so that the council can do its work, and the whole discussion about how it can be funded in the future and the appropriations, I'm sure we'll have in other committees for very long meetings. But I would ask you to review what I've just sent you.
Representative Doty has a question.
Madam Chair, my question was taken care of by Representative Dill. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ansel.
My question was also answered.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth, and then we're going to take a vote.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton, I'll do that too. Did you have a question, Representative Hackbarth?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I still don't think my question was answered. The commissioner has signed an executive order of $100,000 set aside from a not dedicated account within the Game and Fish Fund to get things up and running for up to $100,000. Why do we have this bill here today? Why don't we have a bill that says we're going to pay back the $100,000 once the money starts coming in from the constitutional amendment and we start collecting that money, we're going to pay it back? Why don't we have a bill that simply says
We're going to pay the money back once we start getting some money. Why don't we just say that? You've already got the money by executive order to get the thing up and running for $100,000.
Representative Hanson.
The bill does say that we'll refund the money. We're going to repay that money. That's what the bill does. It's a loan, and it's changing from the fund that was originally identified because of these concerns raised relating to federal Pittman-Robertson-Wallet-Bro dollars. So it's moved to the Water Rec account and provides for that replacement. So I think it's doing, and it's having the legislature vote to do that. So it's a clear appropriation.
What if you increase the $50,000?
Come through the chair, Representative Patchford, please.
Madam Chair, and the reason we were in the original amendment had taken it through October, so that would carry over into the next fiscal year. As I said, and I'm willing, you know, to do an oral amendment for up to, so it's clear if members want to do that or not.
Would you like to move that amendment?
I will move that amendment up to $150,000.
Okay, this would be on line 1.10, shall transfer up to? No, it's on line 1.4. Right, it would be up to $150,000. Do people understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That amendment is adapted. Representative Hamilton, you had a question.
Very quick, Madam Chair. You know, I don't think, I haven't heard anybody dispute the fact that the citizens getting reimbursed for their expenses that are participating on this, which I don't think that's the question. It comes down to this thing morphing into more than what it was originally intended to be. The first time when Representative Bill was talking about that position that would be created, the executive director position, he made the comment about that wasn't the intent initially. And then I think I hear some fear when I heard Representative Anderson say how is this money going to be spent as well, and whether or not we're going to be creating that position. And on the email that was sent out, that's number one there. Does DNR have the authority to hire a position or positions? And then if you flip back through, it starts talking about that executive director position. And again, the fear of this thing morphing into something that was originally intended. So I think that's where the fear lies, and a lot of the questions haven't been answered yet.
I think I'm going to defer to Representative Brazil, because I think he was trying to deal with that in his amendment. It's to see where he used the word office expenses and what was the other, the administrative expenses. There is no authorization specifically in his amendment for an executive director. Am I reading your amendment and your intention correctly, Representative Hill?
You did.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the side, I asked Representative Dill, though, if this could include staffing expenses. So, correct. So, it doesn't prohibit it. It's permissive, correct? I just want to make sure I understand it correctly.
Well, Madam Chair, they already have those expenses, and they have a person that DNR assigned to this, and those expenses would be included in it.
But it wouldn't prohibit them from hiring an executive director, correct?
But my intent is to get them to July 1st, and then let the Heritage Council, the committee that represents Murphy Care, deal with that issue.
The amendment is before us. We have a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Madam Chair.
We are in a roll call. Representative McNamara. And the chair votes aye.
Anderson?
No.
Anzo?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Doe?
It's on your amendment.
Sorry. Doty?
Aye.
Gunther?
Aye.
Hamilton?
No.
Hanson?
Aye.
Portman?
Aye.
Kuhn?
Aye.
Lilly?
Aye.
McNamara?
No.
Scalzi?
Aye.
Torkelson?
No.
Purcell?
Aye.
Hackbart?
No.
There are 12 ayes and 5 nays, and the amendment is adopted. We are on the bill right now, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. again, so that there's better clarity here. Assuming that expenses have been incurred and are owed for reimbursement to council members, that amount of reimbursement will be deducted from the appropriation language and number of up to $150,000. Is that a correct assumption?
That is correct.
The chair made a mistake. We were voting on the bill, not the amendment, because we had already voted on the amendment. So we will redo that because it is the bill that's before us, not the amendment. Representative McNamara, but I want to make sure that's clear to everybody. Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer an oral amendment to change the 150 to 50.
Well, in this case, since we voted on the bill, I think we're just going to have to reconsider, or does everybody just agree that I made a mistake and you all didn't understand what I was saying? Want to just do it that way? People didn't. People thought they were voting on an amendment, right?
No.
You thought the bill.
Because I knew that we already did the voice vote on the amendment.
Okay.
Madam,
for the record.
I did say it wrong.
Madam Chair and members, I think if you would review the record, before the vote was called, it was clearly stated by the chair that we were voting on the bill. It was only after the vote that it was, her comments were that it was on the amendment.
No, that's not true. Listen to the date.
It
said amendment before.
Well,
it said amendment.
Yeah. Okay. The chair is going to take the responsibility for this, and I think we all agree that you want to redo it. That's just going to be fine. But we do have to move then to reconsider, I believe, and Representative McNamara does that.
Madam Chair, I'll make a motion to reconsider the vote that we just took.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? So we will now redo it, but you have an amendment.
Yep. Madam Chair, I really appreciate this discussion. And it's hard, we're on both sides of this issue, many of us along the way. And this thing has really developed in a really positive way. We're evidently taking the money out of the wrong account. We need to fix that, Representative Hansen. You've worked to run this thing on the skinny. I think it's Dr. Kildor. Is it doctor? I don't want to do it wrong. Or
Mike.
Okay. Mr. Kildor. We should... Commissioner Meyer, you haven't spent that much. $50,000 would be enough. Let's just make an oral amendment to change the 150 to 50. It says in statute you can spend the money. If you need to spend the money, it's there. You can pre-spend it. As Representative Hackbart has already said, let's get it straightened out. And your intent is to run it, but these folks need to get reimbursed for their expenses. And I agree with that. And Madam Chair, I'd just like to change the 150 to 50.
Madam Chair, I would oppose the amendment. I believe that with the up to language, you will actually be getting the real expenses. I think the main cost here is not going to be the compensation of the citizen members. It's going to be the time incurred by DNR staff, which from the beginning initiation of this until June 30th, I'm guessing will probably go over $50,000. So I think the bill that is in front of you is okay, and I would urge members to vote against the amendment.
If there is an amendment before you, members, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
Amendment is not adopted. Members, the bill is now...
division.
Okay, we have a division here. All those in favor of the amendment to change it to 50,000, raise your hand. Okay. All opposed. There were 7 yes for the amendment, 9 no for the amendment. The amendment was not adopted. Members, the bill is before you. I don't see any more conversation. We will do the roll call again. and the chair votes for the bill. Okay.
First up. Sorry, I'm not going in order. First up.
Aye.
Hagbart?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Anvil?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Bill?
Yep.
Sody?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hamilton?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Portman?
Aye.
Knuth?
Aye.
Lilly?
Aye.
McNamara?
No.
Salzy?
Aye.
Torkelson?
No.
There being 12 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is passed and recommended to go to finance with further recommendations that it go to the Cultural and Outdoor Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen. It's the CCA's turn to come forth.
Thank you. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
I will.
Welcome, Madam Chair. First, thank you, Madam Chair.
Good job.
We have stuff in our package from them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Myrna Hallback, and I'm the director of our the PCA Operational Support Division. With me today is Val Miller, our finance manager. As we talk today about our FY08-09 budget and outcomes, the agency's effort on that is based to our 2006 strategic plan. Our strategic plans are intended to address two biennium with small adjustments in the second, so they're intended to be four-year plans. Particularly for the 2006, that plan was updated after the OEA, the Office of Environmental Assistance, joined the agency, and so we needed to amend that. I just need to recognize that we've also had some, I think, very good discussions with the chair on how we really can do the budgeting and showing our results that way connected to the financial part. I unfortunately have not succeeded in doing that as yet, and will continue to work with the chair on how to do that, particularly as we move forward with 10 and 11. So what I've provided you today is a copy of the strategic plan, a copy of, and then in a separate document, the FTEs that we have devoted per a work plan. All of our staff are required to do a work plan into one database, and we rolled it up to the agency's database. And then with that, the 08-09 budget separated out by function. Now, one of the things that we've actually done is there are now 7 functions, and we found that the 4 functions that you will see in the budget don't really work to describe the work. So one of the things we will be doing in 10 and 11 is adding some additional breakdowns with that to do. And the last thing on that, in that document, is some examples of the outcomes that we do, just so that you can see how we report and work to each other and try to do that. Today I won't be providing necessarily those outcomes that you see. I am going to, as I walk through, try to provide some unique and different types so that you can see the sorts of things we measure. First of all, I will just start briefly with our PCA mission, a little bit about the strategic plan. I do want to talk a little bit about our performance measurement system and what we do, what we are looking for, a little background on the agency design and its structure, and then some budget details as we think of them broken out in land, environmental assistance, air, water, multimedia, and our operational support. You will see when we come to 10 and 11, and I will clarify this when we do the budget, that we have modified those areas to better show that our environmental assistance and our multimedia are often linked. And so we have linked that as we go forward in the new biennium. Again, we are working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, improve the environment and enhance our quality, and that is because we do not ourselves do much of the work. We're either working directly with municipalities, the industry, or more recently, because the remaining efforts in the environment are really with the citizens. So you will see that we have a commitment to both the education, our work being done with locals, the clean water legacy money that you gave us in the past biennium, 80% of that was actually passed on to locals to help do that. It's not about the agency. We can't do this alone. Again, our strategic plan does have vision goals and objectives for us on the environmental area. We are still short. You'll see in there is an excellence goal or an operational support goal. We do need to work on that. That is about how we are better, how we are streamlined, how we make sure that things are formed out so that the citizens can see it. You'll also see, as you look at that strategic plan, one of the most recent issues that we've all been dealing with is climate change and greenhouse gas. That became part of the 2008 strategic plan, and so you will see that related in our new budget request, and you will see that in the new strategic plan. Our governance, we're unique. We do have a citizens board established in statute, and that board sets policy and direction. If you have been watching our board at all, and we do webcast our board meetings now, so anyone can go online and watch them. They've asked for a water study, but NEQB has been doing that, and that was because of their concern about the amount of groundwater used by industry and whether we have enough going forward. They've also questioned staff about greenhouse gas and what are we doing as far as that. So they are very engaged in the work we do and provide a unique perspective to our work. And as we move forward, our new commissioner has talked about indeed how they would help us guide policies and that we will be engaging them in more of those discussions. We are unique because they do represent the citizens, and citizens have an ability to come to that board meeting and speak. The other thing we do is we work closely with the EPA and the Environmental Protection Agency, and in fact with that they've given us authority to run our Superfund cleanup, the air permitting programs, and the water permitting programs. So in those areas we actually act on behalf of the federal government to do, and we take that seriously. The other sorts of partnerships that we have are with the other state agencies. You'll hear throughout this where we have to work with the Department of Health and Ag in order to accomplish the missions, particularly in the groundwater area. You'll hear that some of our activities move forward water conservation because we have a unique opportunity with a technical assistance provider and work with industry to actually conserve water. DNR actually has that on the authority of the state. So there are things like that we need to do together. We also work with counties in many of our programs. feedlots is often, that program is carried out as much by the counties as us, and so we have money that we pass through with them on their activities. The same is done with construction stormwater. We have joint power agreements with entities out there to help do the inspections on our behalf and understand those. Household hazardous waste, solid waste are also done mostly at the county level, and we provide SCORE funding and we provide household hazardous waste funding. So again, as I indicated, we really do not accomplish our job and our measures alone to do this. The other sorts of things we try to do is engage advisory boards. We are part of the Environmental Education Advisory Board, and that's where we can really stress environmental education into the schools and work with folks on that. We have a stormwater advisory group that's very engaged with us and has undertaken in the past year working with us to redesign the stormwater program so it's more effective. That redesign isn't done, but the actual citizens and groups on there are advising us as much as us. And then we do stakeholder efforts depending on whether we're doing rules. I'm currently undertaking air and water fee rules that we'll talk more about in the new budget. And we undertake and we have stakeholders. And we ask them up front and then we go back to them. When we're doing some reports, we require that those advisory groups stay with us longer to develop it. And in some cases, they're very short term. Now, I thought it would be valuable as we start with the 08-09 objectives, but also as we think about 10 and 11 next week, we won't have to repeat this, but I thought I would start today to talk a little bit about the agency's performance management that we have been working on and modifying as we go forward. And while we developed a strategic plan based on what we understand the legislature and others to have us achieve, we also have what's called an EMPA, and that's an Environmental Performance Partnership Agreement with the EPA. And we need to track and meet the objectives of the EPA as well to get any funding from them. They do their individual audits of our both our programs and our funding and how we use it, so we need to meet theirs. They test us very closely on are we meeting inspection requirements, are our permits getting done in the time frame, do we have the right kinds of things in the permits, do we actually maintain the files properly in order that there be a complete record of the decision, which is very important to us all. And then we're also looking at how the financial system is set up in the biennial spending plan in order to work with that, so that we develop our strategic plan, develop our work, and then set the financial plan in place to accomplish that. You will see that our measurements are not as effective on the financial part, and that's an area that we know we're currently redesigning and looking to do that. We have a four-year strategic plan, a two-year legislative biennial spending, and we really have a one-year spending plan. Both are not in sync very well to make sure that the long-term objectives are met by the agency. We will be doing that. My next slide, I know it's not readable, and that's a violation of any kind of presentation, but I want to let you know where we're headed. At the far left, we will be keeping our objectives. We're looking to who is actually responsive for meeting a particular objective. There will be strategies. So in this case, this is about reducing household hazardous waste, so that we as citizens reduce it. Our strategies for that would be education and outreach, promoting product stewardship so they don't have it at all, and then actually devise the database so we have good tracking and reporting on it. Amazingly so, when I worked at the county in the 90s, I did household hazardous waste,
and we at the state still don't have a functional database to help what we report into it. So we just need to do that so that we can use that information both for understanding the products still out there and then what we're actually collecting it and doing.
Representative Clark has a question.
Okay. Is there another place where we can read this chart? I can't read it either on the handout here or up there.
I'll bring you a better copy of it. I will bring a handout that has it in black and white.
I mean, it's just that typing is so small that maybe younger eyes can read it.
Yes.
Don't look at me.
I will bring copies for the committee and you'll be able to read that. It'll be in black and white in larger print. I knew I was violating good ethics. Relative to the metrics, one of the things for our performance management is to twice a year look at our work in two different ways. One is operational. That's in the spring of the year, so we'll be doing that in March and April. And the other is strategic, which will be the environmental, and that'll be in the fall. And then what we have provided is kind of metrics, and it's not readable, and we'll fix that. And then the place for us to actually comment on the results. So what do we need to change? How are we getting? What's missing from here is the FTEs devoted to it, and then the finance component of that. And so those are things I think we can begin to look at, and whether we roll them up again, to the highest goal, the objective, or does each objective have those? I'd like to engage in that conversation. To do. Organizationally and structured. We are currently at a little over 900 staff in 8 offices. We have 8 divisions, industrial, regional, municipal. Those 3 divisions in particular are our service divisions, and they are set up based on kind of how their work goes. The industrial is, as you might imagine, mostly industrial type facilities. So our hazardous ways, the air permitting is often done in those areas. Power plants are an example of what you would find there. Regional are really dealing with things that go across boundaries and deal at the local level. And so those are found in our 5 regions. We have a couple of the regions big enough that we have 2 offices in those. And they deal with our watershed work and the feedlot program and the environmental review. And so, again, thinking on a broader perspective. Municipal, again, just as it speaks, they connect a lot to local government, whether it actually be a city or a county. So our solid waste planning, our stormwater work is there, and our municipal wastewater ISPS work is there. Prevention and assistance, mostly that is former Office of Environmental Assistance. But we've added to it. They really do provide us the technical and financial assistance out and bring a perspective on the regulatory work for us. Remediation is our cleanup area, so our Superfund, closed landfill, leaky underground tanks are taken care of in that area. Environmental analysis and outcomes. There were a lot of our monitoring and an evaluation of conditions in the environment exist. They also determine the standards and look at the condition and health of the environment. They complete a 5-year stressor report, and our latest one will be out probably this week, actually, and be on the web. And that stressor report takes a look at whether it's a chemical area, or whether it's development, is it the runoff that's impacting particular rivers and streams, the air? That report is then used by the programs to think about how they can relieve or remove the stressors to keep the environmental health. Operational support, as you might imagine, is where our communication, accounting, financial management, human resources, exist for the MPCA. Data and performance management is actually a newer
division to us, this is where we're really going to focus in the data management and where we make our data accessible to people. So right now, there's a significant change going on in our data platform, and I'll show that next week, is to how to make our facility information more accessible to the general public. And that includes compliance, includes permitting information, and so we will actually try to provide you a couple of slides to show how that's moving. In the past, it's called What's in My Neighborhood, and in the past that was really used just to determine where paints were. And so we're broadening that much out based on what we've heard from folks wanting to be able to go in electronically and do that. That's also a strong connector for the rest of us to think about our data. The information that I have been able to achieve in the past for this committee has come from those people to do. And then we have the commissioner's office, which has three assistants. And they work in the land, air, and water, and also work across informational pieces for us. I'm ready to go into the budget. You want to start that tonight?
I think we might as well, if you're getting ready to go into... I think we are ready to recess till tonight. We've got like 1 minute left. So we are going to recess until this evening. We are going to get through all of the FCCA's tonight. I think we're going to be going a little bit faster because we don't have the results from PCA yet. And so what we're hoping for now is to have the results tied to the budget in 2011. So we will be at 6:30 in room 200. Okay, and if you put your handouts in your folders, then they'll be ready for you this evening. Meeting is in recess.
I'm going to reconvene the committee and just remind us of what our objective is here. We have been asking agencies what they have accomplished in the last 2 years, or last year and a half, with the money that we allocated in the last budget. And the point of this is to look at the strategic plan. PCA has given us this strategic plan and tie their dollars to the outcomes that they are delivering for Minnesotans. So with that reminder of what we are doing, and that's what we want to concentrate on, and also the reminder that PCA will be here next week to give the governor's budget, and I want to make sure we don't do repeating here. We're concentrating on what we accomplished in the last year and a half. So with that, if you want to go ahead.
Just now, can I get rid of a cough drop in my mouth? Okay. To do. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm starting on what would be slide 9 on your numbers there, and just giving you an overlook of what was given us in the appropriation last session. Most of it you can read. The point I thought I would point out is the general fund is 17% of the budget only because of the one-time funding that came, and the biggest share of that was the monies around the Clean Water Legacy Act. Without that increased number, the general fund was actually 8% of the budget. To do. The other component that I thought I would mention for the receipts in, because I believe it'll become part of it, and just as aware, as we think about permitting and the receipts that come into the environmental fund from permitting, they cover about 25% of the receipts into that under the current collection.
Do you want to see that one more time?
The permit fees that we collect are about 25% of the total in the environmental fund. Or in this case, they were nearly $44 million. I'll move through this slide quickly. This is just to show the trend and how, with the exception of the 08-09, the portion of the general fund in our budget is meaning steady, slowly declining a little bit, and we'll talk more next week about what it is under the governor's 10 and 11. So then as you look in this case by program, water is by far our biggest program. 33% of our staff work in this area. Of the general fund, 80% of it goes to the water program, and that includes those things that areas that we pass through to local government, to the TVOT program, Clean Water Partnership, and in this case, the TMDL and the assessment monitoring. The land program is the next biggest part, and of that, remediation is the largest part of that. As you think about the large cleanup activities at landfills, so Washington County landfill, reserve mining, Flying Cloud, those are the biggest areas where our dollars go. Multimedia, I just want to highlight, this is an area, again, where we cross activities, and so for our mercury reduction activities, this is a unique thing because we finished our TMDL, mercury TMDL, and I will show you later the difference that will make, but that's actually a water issue going to be resolved through many of our air activities and somewhat in the land program. That TMDL became a national model where other states used it. So again, I don't think it's necessary for me to read what our core environmental programs are. Impaired waters for us stands alone, partly because during this, the 08-09 biennium, it was one-time funded, and so we needed to focus on it and achieve the goals that were established in legislature. So I thought I would start with the land programs. Again, it's a breakdown within the $100 million budget for the land. Most of that is funded through the remediation fund. And again, most of that work goes towards our closed landfill program. Our vision for land is that the land actually is supporting desired uses. In other words, free of pollution that reduces those options. We minimize the release of contaminants to or from the land, and we store contaminated land back to productive use. You'll see this format repeated through it. With each of our programs, we think of the highest activity of prevention, and then we try to manage, and if you must, clean up. Again, it's much cheaper to prevent and manage things in that fashion than it is to clean up afterwards. So our first goal was to conserve our resources and prevent land pollution. So by 2010, we wanted to be collecting 500 tons of lead per year out of the disposal process. And we also wanted to, by 2007, and the data hasn't been updated yet, growth in the municipal solid waste generation not exceed the population growth. So for the lead,
As you're talking about the lead, I mean, without a context, 500 tons a year, how much is actually in from disposal? So what does that mean? Is this 5% or 50% or what?
You know, I don't have that context. We will try. We will answer that question and report back to you. Because I am sure the staff have that estimate. With our Get the Lead Out program, we've been operating that. Really, this is one of the ways we work to educate citizens on what they can do and the damage that we have. And so we do tackle exchanges. We're actually at the sports show often and with a bald eagle as part of our presentation and the dangers that actually are caused to them by eating dead deer and others that have lead in them. It's actually quite prevalent. So there's a both a water issue with this, and there's actually an issue to the, our wildlife.
Again, it would be helpful to have, I mean, 1,137 pounds of lead out of.
Yep. Yes. The other newest area that I wanted to talk a little bit about is the e-waste program. That's a very new program where we're collecting CRTs and televisions. And so, this again is my the trend in waste management. You can see just our waste continues to go up instead of leveling off and coming down. If you remember last year with the MTAG and the climate exchange reports, the goal is to reduce the amount of waste actually generated. And so we do not yet in 08-09 have the strategies of how we're going to approach that. But in our 1 year of statewide collection, these are the various ways that we collected e-waste and the amount of tonnage. These are million pounds collected. So we had special events that collected 8 million pounds. Now, what the staff has not yet been able to do is take that and convert that to the amount of lead and other hazardous contaminants in that. So we have just gotten the yearly data that shows how much has been collected. Our next step will be actually to say how much is there.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
I have a question. I'm sorry to ask you to go back one slide on the trends in waste management. It looks like the proportion of waste to energy is actually shrinking. And I'm wondering if you know if that's attributable to decreased delivery from the metro area to waste-to-energy facilities.
Madam Chair, members, that's actually one of the incinerators closed.
Do you know which one?
The one up in Purvis Falls.
Okay. Just a follow-up question. I represent portions of both Anoka County and Hennepin County. And I know they have an agreement pertaining to delivery of waste to an Elk River facility to convert it to waste to energy. And I know there's a statute that requires municipal solid waste in the Southern County metro area to be pre-processed before it's either landfilled or incinerated, and that if somebody wants to incinerate it without pre-processing or landfill it without pre-processing, that they have to certify that that's not available. My understanding is that's not happening in Hennepin County. Can you maybe not in this forum, but could somebody maybe get back to me about what's going on with regard to municipal solid waste not being pre-processed?
Actually, if you could just submit that in writing, we will get it around to every member because I suspect members will all be interested in that issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will do that.
Yes, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Is there a viable substitute for lead in e-waste?
Yes. They actually are replacing it with less. And I don't know all the detail, but I do know that they have substitutes for it. And they're, and much like the circuitry, it's really, they use less lead to solder things together now in the boards and doing that. And so that's where a big part of it is. And then the panels are created differently. So that's another portion of where they reduce the lead. Liquid crystal uses a little bit less. But we will report that as well. And I will have the experts on it. Thank you. Again, in this part of the e-waste collection, I just wanted to show a little bit, just an easy, quick view on the bar chart, the burgundy being non-natural. Their source of the difference in the ways they collected it. As you might imagine, special events or permanent sites are pretty much equal. Permanent sites are. The mail back happens more here. Incidental happens more. And that is actually roadside cleanup for what might happen on the tipping floor and collected at incinerators. So we know that part of the reason that e-waste came as a product stewardship was because of the abandoning that waste in the road ditches out in the rural area.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slid by this slide here too fast for me, I guess. It's the one, trends in waste management. There you go. And I just curious, up in land program outcomes, I don't, the slides aren't numbered, so I can't, I guess maybe they are numbered, but I can't read them. Maybe 16. But it says, and I heard you say this, January 2007 growth in municipal solid waste generation does not exceed population growth rate. Is that reflected in this chart? Has that goal been met, sir?
The goal has not been met. And we are actively looking at the sorts of strategies. We're trying to look at more recycling, so we have a campaign on Recycle More. We're also looking at some other strategies. Those sorts of strategies would be reflected in the next strategic plan and our outcome.
So as a population, we're creating more waste than less.
That's correct.
Okay.
You have, I mean, your last number, Trends in Waste Management, is 2005. Do you not have 6, 7, and 8?
They do, but I could... they have it in raw numbers, but it starts to get a little delay, and we did not get it into the chart.
It's just a second. Representative Portman.
I won't talk like this all the time. Just a follow-up comment to Representative Purcell. I was just wondering if you saw the movie WALL-E this summer, because I think that was the point of the movie.
I'm sorry.
There's a Disney movie, WALL-E. It's about how we're creating more and more waste all the time. It was a not subtle message of the movie.
I'm told I go back to Jonathan Livingston Seagull, so
I'll bring you a DVD.
Okay, thank you.
I think all of that is to tell you we have lots of interest in waste, and I think it would be helpful to put the 2006, 7, and 8 numbers in this chart and just hand it out separately.
We will do that. Our second goal under the land program was to minimize and reduce the release of contaminants. One of the preventive measures is our above and underground storage tank program, and where we're trying to achieve 75% of them being in compliance. And then also for our hazardous waste program, which is a preventive program, having 90% of those in compliance.
That's by January 6th. Are they in compliance?
They are. They achieve regularly at 95%, and I will tell you that rather than continue just to inspect facilities in compliance, we, during the last couple of years, we actually modified our approach and focused in on hospital waste. And that was a large initiative, and because they are in compliance, we're able to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you brought up hospital waste, I'm curious what kind of interactions you have with hospitals and their disposal of pharmaceuticals, and what those requirements are, and how you work with them to keep them out of our wastewater stream.
Madam Chair, members, pharmaceuticals are our newest endeavor with the hospitals, and much like we did with their general solid waste, we are working with them through the associations to do. With pharmaceuticals, it's a little bit different than we were able to do with the hazardous waste in that because they're drugs, we have to work with DEA and the federal government on how to appropriate that. The original thought was we could guide people to have the household hazardous waste program pick them up, but because they're drugs, that adds a lot of work there. So we still haven't quite figured out how to do that, but we're doing it in conjunction with the hospital association so that they can look at it. And I can give an update when we report the other two on just where the staff are on that. Again, not only are the hazardous waste facilities in compliance, they are reducing the amount generated. And of course, our overall goal would be that we have no hazardous waste generated and used for waste. Because there are, as we continue to go along, many times there are substitutes that we can do. And through our association with MNTAP at the university, we're able to send out student interns and work directly with businesses and find those substitutes. So we're actually moving people out of the regulatory program. The other, this is a report on the outstate part of the hazardous waste collected from the hospitals. And you'll see 2005 is when we started intensive inspection and working with them. And so there were about 14 million pounds collected then. We reached a peak in 2006, nearly 16 million. 2007, we actually started to see a large difference. And that is because as we found the hazardous waste, that meant hospitals had to increase their budgets to manage this appropriately. And so for a large hospital, that sometimes meant $400,000 a year. For the smaller ones, that was a $30,000 to $50,000 budget increase. And so they really did start to find different ways to manage it and substitute it. And since that time, the reason you don't have 2008 on here is hazardous waste, and that is reported annually. So those numbers are just coming in. So 2007 would be the most up-to-date data on that. Goal 3 for our land program is restore contaminated land. And in this case, I elected to report on two areas. One is our restoring, our goal of restoring 3,600 acres of contaminated land through our voluntary investigation and cleanup program. And then also really effectively manage our Superfund sites. And I'll show some examples of where Superfund has been in existence for a number of years. But I first want to talk about voluntary program. Since 1988 when we started, and this is actually a fee-for-service program. So we are actually paid for the hours we work. We have just completed an analysis with the many people who use this, both the actual clientele and then consultants, to streamline and reduce our cost for that so that we could reduce the hourly rate that we do. We also found that our billing to them was confusing and they had no idea what we were billing them for, so we have started to improve our invoicing and do it more timely. We often sent them quarterly bills that were all lumped, and by the time 3 months passed, they don't remember how many hours. And so we've worked with them very closely to improve that. So that's kind of an immediate accountability if they don't know what you're doing. This program has won national awards. Much of the land, as you can see, has been over the last 20 years has been redeveloped, been able to sell it, refinance it. In 2008, we did not meet our acreage that we wanted to do. We only had 1,500 acres restored, but as you might imagine, the economy impacts the ability for people to invest in this sort of work as well. We typically do and look through 200 new projects a year. A couple of the ones some of you might be familiar with are the restoration of the Phelan Corridor and the Gopher Football Stadium is actually being done on an old site. And so there's a lot of cleanup and oversight with it. With the Superfund, we've had it since 1983, and there were 255 sites put that through that. 159 of them we consider closed out. So there are still 96 sites that we need to monitor regularly and complete O&M on it. And our goal is to eliminate any of our interaction with those and so they can be put back to productive use. Of course, you probably know about the more recent issues in this program. While it's been fairly stable, the PFC issue, vapor intrusion. We did the first vapor intrusion investigation with EPA. We had to look at 270 homes in St. Louis Park. 40 of them needed remediation action so that the vapor stopped impacting their homes, and we spent between federal and state dollars over $1 million. With that knowledge, we then have begun looking at our files and have said there's a potential of 3,100 sites that may have issues with vapors. We're estimating based on our first preliminary that 5 to 20% of them will actually need some kind of work on them. So we're doing detailed file work now.
Representative Gunther.
I have my question answered.
Representative Clark.
I'm just wondering if you could give us a little elaboration on what's going on with the PFCs. This is the dot on there, but I could talk a little bit about what's going on with that.
Maybe I can have Tim Schirkenbach, our assistant commissioner who leads the land program, and leads that activity.
Yes, my name is Tim Schirkenbach. I'm acting deputy commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. Madam Chair, Representative Clark, right now maybe the best way we could do that is look at, we have kind of divided it in about two or three different areas. One is the remediation relative to the actual 3M site. And there we have investigations and actually cleanups underway at the Woodbury and Oakdale sites. And then what we have is a plan developed for cleaning up the Chemelite site. And so those are going underway. The Chemelite site will actually get into the river where we actually have some sediments in the river as a result of their discharge. So the plan includes even what would happen in the river on dealing with that. In addition, what we have is a plan for the Washington County landfill, which accepted waste. And even though that is in our closed landfill program, so normally that would be covered under the program because it's really under the control of the state, what's happening there is through a consent order, they did agree to spend $8 million to help on the cleanup of that. Right now, what we're trying to do is make sure we have bonding or state money available so that we can actually go ahead with that. There was some legislation last year for some revenue bonds, but what was backing up those bonds, the Attorney General staff has indicated there's some problems with that. Then the broader issue is we're finding that PFCs were not only generated by 3M in this state, but they've been generated by other companies. So what we have is investigations going on that go beyond just the East Metro area, looking around the state. And what we should probably do is, we have a report that we just presented to our agency board last month that is a very long report that goes into a number of different areas of investigation, which includes air monitoring, monitoring around landfills, monitoring from wastewater treatment facilities, monitoring in lakes around the state where we have found PFCs. And I think what we're finding is it is a very ubiquitous thing. Even from the start, it's been found in the blood of polar bears up north and everything else. And so what we're finding out is we are taking it on as a state issue, but it's really kind of a national global issue. And what we're trying to do is at least do as much as we can using some money we have from 3M. They agreed to contribute about $5 million for investigations in the state. We're also trying to work to get EPA more engaged in dealing and helping us with some of these issues. But I think it may be worthwhile. It's really the report, we spent about an hour explaining that report to our agency board, and maybe that would be worth some additional discussion here, because it's kind of hard to summarize in just a few minutes. But it goes into a lot of different areas. We're also finding out that there are some things. Perfluoral chemicals mean all the carbon links are fluorinated. There are now, we're finding out that there are some fluorinated chemicals that are being generated that actually, in the, as they decompose, can turn into perfluorinated compounds. And so that's what's really complicating what we're seeing. And we actually think that there's, again, things being generated now that are adding to the TSC problem, both in this state but elsewhere, that are really starting to complicate the issue as we're trying to figure out where it is in the Minnesota environment and how it's getting there.
Just a follow-up, in terms of the other, are you thinking about other industry sources? And if so, could you mention what an example or two of what you're talking about?
Well, there's actually alcohols that are used in a number of industrial processes to help catalyze things in the chemical reactions, and that's a fluorinated compound, and DuPont is generating those now. And so that's out there in the environment, and I forget the figure, how many millions of pounds they generated just in the last few years that is out there.
I'm talking about in Minnesota. Are you talking about DuPont in Minnesota?
Well, it's, again, used throughout industry everywhere. I mean, even what we found is, and we found it in, as we tried to permit the Brainerd wastewater treatment facility, we found, and as our initial efforts to kind of screen around the state and see where PFCs were, we found PFCs in the effluent from the Brainerd wastewater treatment system. What we then found out, it was actually as a result of PFCs used in a chrome plating industry within the Brainerd city. And what was happening as the PFCs there, and this is the very kind of complicated thing, the PFCs were required under the Clean Air Act as part of best available control technology for dealing with vapors from the chrome process. And so, and the chrome and the PFCs that were being used were being generated outside the country and brought in to the country. And actually, under EPA TSCA regulations, there are some exemptions for use of PFCs if actually they have some other beneficial use, such as in this chrome plating industry.
Okay. I think I heard you say that you're also looking at airborne sources or airborne examples. Is that right?
Yes.
And then, so I just turned out that's a big change from what last year I asked about the...
Well...
And actually, I have in writing statement from the agency saying that they didn't think that PFCs were airborne or vaporized, and I knew that there were studies that said they were, but apparently the agency now accepts that.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, what I should indicate, I use that in a broad brush way. In the past, we have actually, because of concerns from the Washington County landfill, part of the treatment system at Washington County, in order to deal with the organics that were in the groundwater, is to bring it up to the surface, spray it up, and then have the volatile chemicals vaporized. So at some point in time, we looked at and did some testing out there relative to that. So that's what I was looking at that's even gone to that. What we had done is we've also looked at, from the 3M incinerator at the Chemolite plant, at least tried to understand what information existed from that. And we've taken a look at that and found that it was not an amount that really could be counted, or it was not at a level that we felt we could in any way attribute to what was going on in the area.
Nancy, I just got mixed up. The last part you were talking about was the Chemolite, but the, in terms of aerating in the Washington County landfill, that was significant.
No, we did not find it to be significant. The idea of what was being aerated there and the calculations and the modeling that our staff did, we did not think it was a significant contributor to any issue in the neighborhood, based upon also the information we had from the health department as far as how the body uptakes TSC.
I'm trying to say, I'd love to see something in writing about that, because I've had some correspondence with the agency about this because of some concerns, especially with some of the land around there that is.
Okay.
And I actually, this summer that I had a conversation with, I think, Assistant Commissioner Thornton about this issue of the spigot that flows the.
Yeah, used as part of the treatment out there. Well, we can look into the information we provided and make sure that we get you the true picture of it. But that's my recollection of it, Representative Clark. I'm sorry. But, yep.
Representative Gunther?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Assistant Commissioner, can you tell me what do PFCs do to a person? How do they get in your bones and stay there, or what do they do?
Actually, I'm probably not the best person. From looking at the report, there's a lot of different things, and I want to be careful as I talk about it. I think the big thing is how it gets into the blood and some of the organs of the body, and at certain concentrations when it starts to have an impact. It's a chronic impact. It's not an acute impact. So it's over a period of a lifetime that usually you look at the impacts that are there.
I thought we had some problem for fetuses too.
Yes, I think you're right, and that
couldn't remember. Madam Chairman, it kind of reminds me of stories I used to hear about fluoride they put in toothpaste, that it stays with you forever. I don't know if that's true or not, but what you just said about other fluorocarbons and stuff like that might be.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, the big thing with for fluorocaine, they're long carbon chains. In fact, what they're finding is the big concern with perfluorinated chemicals is when they get to longer chain lengths, then they're bioaccumulative. They don't pass through the body very quickly. And so I think it's different than fluorine as such or fluorinated smaller chain carbons. And so a lot of it has to do with the size of the chain. In fact, what 3M has done now is they got into production, and they went from the production of 8 or greater chain chemicals that were perfluorinated to those that were 6 or 4 chain length chemicals. And that has a big difference in how long it resides in the body and how quickly it passes through. And again, the longer something resides in the body, the more likely it is to bioaccumulate and accumulate up. And so it's very complicated stuff to understand all the different variables that are involved in some of those things.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to talk about Superfund there. a couple questions. And if you don't know, you can get back. But regarding the sites that you have there, you talked about 96 sites, and just curious on a breakdown of NPL sites versus state list. And how many RPMs, how many sites per RPM that you have, that kind of thing?
I do not have that off the top of my head.
Okay.
Back to you.
I think since part of the funding that we do is for Superfund sites, that a good chart, just one page, on what sites are out there, what the cost of cleanup is, and what the plan is for how we get through those. Is that helpful? Would be helpful?
Right, Madam Chair. Yeah, you've got so many people that are remedial project managers that are, you know, and they're doing so many sites and that kind of a thing. And some idea of the workload, you know. It'll break down to your FTEs, et cetera. Just one follow-up, if I may. Has the depletion, this is where I was coming from with the NPL site stuff, has the depletion of the federal Superfund, I think it was 95 when that sunsetted, is that impacting the state's ability to address NPL sites?
Madam Chair, members, no. We were actually in Superfund before the federal government was. One of my early jobs for the agency was actually one of the initial groups that worked on that, and we continue to move forward and do it. So it really is about kind of what's going on at the site. So, you know, if we're still seeing groundwater contamination, even though we're working on it, we're not going to move it from that priority.
Quick, if I can, just so that there's a state fund that you access if there isn't a responsible party. You don't have to. You don't use the federal super fund. And I know there's some money in it, but it's really, really dwindling.
Right. We can use either to do it, and then go. Even though there might not be a responsible party to start with, and then go seek damages to try to cover it. But the way the Minnesota Superfund program has always been is that we do the cleanup first, you know, and try to solve it, then we go get the money. And so that's been the history both on the state side and then when the federal came in to do it. We continue to work that way. Most of the Superfund sites, you know, we're into kind of that stage. We're either cleaning up, you know, and we're ongoing operation maintenance. The change in our leaky underground storage tank has moved from responsible parties into what we call fund finance, where we again have to use state money, do the cleanup, and then go after them. So it's been kind of a reverse for that program.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm not sure. I guess he's gone. Are you Assistant Commissioner? I'm sorry, or Mr. Schirkenbach? Okay. I live over on the East Metro, and I'm kind of pretty familiar with Highway 5. There's some of the sites with regards to 3M, and I think they've done some cleanup. And I just had a question. Do you know what's going on Highway 5 there? Or is that, are you the wrong person to kind of ask? It's between fairly close to 120 and Highway 5, or is that way too specific of a kind of a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I wish I could help you on that. When the different numbers, I know in general about the sites, but the specific locations. And is that in the Oakdale?
Yes,
sir. Talking about? Yes, it is. Okay. And I think what we could probably do, to be fair, I think what we should do is get you more information on that, because actually we had just gone through a remedial action decision document on that, explaining the treatment that we were felt was the appropriate for that. I know there's a neighborhood in the area that is still concerned with some groundwater issues there. But in order to get you the right information, what I would like to do is go back and we can make sure that I get it right rather than trying to remember off the top of my head here.
If you would do that, that would be good.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, can I just throw it out? Thank you. And I just for further, and maybe you can take this, you know, with you.
Yep.
And now that we're talking about the airborne, right there, there's some sort of treatment going on, and you know, it's fenced off, kind of a thing. And then there's all sorts of pipes coming out of the ground. But one of the things that's bothered me for years, but no one else can smell it, but me apparently. But if you drive through there with like in a low fog kind of situation, sure, in the evening, if you got your windows down, and I've noticed that when I come home from work or something, I'll be drive through that corridor and it has a unique smell. And I've asked people from your department, and no one knows what I'm talking about. But I'm quite certain that I'm smelling something chemical, and I don't know if it's, you know, something used to actually treat, or if it's some chemical that's coming out. I would just,
okay,
curious.
Madam Chair and Representative, what we'll do is go back, and I understand now what your issue is, and we'll try to figure out exactly that area, what the treatment is, what it would potentially mean relative to some type of an odor that should be noticed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a site on the north side of Highway 5 and on the south side, so it's
okay.
I'm not sure where it's coming from.
I think, yeah, we could provide good maps of that, so we could help to indicate looking at kind of an aerial view or a plot plan on dealing with that.
You want to continue?
The next area that I'd like to move through is our environmental assistance program. And nearly 100% of this is from the Environmental Fund. And again, a lot of that part is the solid waste tax that does go into the fund. And then it's passed back out through SCORE grants to local counties, to household hazardous waste grants, again, to counties to do. And so this is one of our key areas that for the waste management side we're actually working with counties. This is actually where we also managed the green fleet. There was last biennium a one-time funding of $2.4 million for the biennium, and the green fleet where we're moving buses, retrofitting diesel buses so that the school children are not impacted by it, and our goal again is all of those buses. Unfortunately, I didn't choose, but I will do it. That is one of the slides I brought, so we'll get you the actual numbers because I'm sure most of the folks here will be interested in it. And we do have a report on that to do.
Can I just ask what percentage of the buses that you've converted?
That's the information I don't have on the top of my head, Representative Clark, but we will do that. We actually know how many buses there are, and so we know how many we've done, and there is a percentage. And because we were so active in this, we were actually able to get a grant from EPA to move it along even farther. And we're doing so well, that's actually potentially a stimulus item that's coming forward under the package. So.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just one of the things I was hoping that we could look at where the geographical distribution of that money is going.
I'll add that to our document.
Okay. One of the concerns I have is certainly representing an inner city area where people are very transit bus dependent, and we have a lot of buses going down our streets, and I know that the main source of asthma are these mobile sources, so I'm interested in what kind of progress we're making. Thank you.
Because we know exactly the schools, so we can do that to do. Again, this is our in environmental assistance. This is where we do a lot of work for Minnesotans to take their responsibility, buying green products, reducing their use of environmentally harmful substances, and then acting on what they know. So the first one, buying green products, again, this is, I talked to you about our household hazardous waste using 15%. We did not achieve that, and so we do have new strategies coming forward in our new strategic plan to do that. We also are working very hard that we collect new waste and get folks in, and I'll show you that slide in a moment. And then the other one, which we have decided is not really the largest focus for us, and that is buying preferable purchasing and environmental friendly products. There's actually state law to that, and the Department of Admin does quite well on that. And particularly now where they can all purchase under common agreements. Our effort in that is really with the solid waste plans and having counties focus on that area. So for household hazardous waste, we've seen an increase. And again, these numbers lag behind in the calendar years, and so the data is older. But what we're seeing is there still is nearly 100 pounds of waste coming in for in the metro area where it's a new person coming in. So while this program has been in place since 1990, we're still getting many first-time users, and they're still having a lot of waste with us. As someone who used to run this, I was completely amazed about that all the time. The other part, for the non-metro area, they report roughly about 60 pounds a person. But they do not track as detailed as the metro basis on their electronics and their lamps, so they don't get credit for some of the other waste they do. So they're probably reasonably comparable to the metro. Again, as I said about the environmentally preferable purchases, Department of Admin really has seen since 2001 the value of that go up, and so we're doing more of it. We've increased the products that can do that. And then for our role, it's really about how we work with the counties in their solid waste plan. And so this is one of the strategies in our plan that changed from 2006 to 2008. Again, trying to define where the role of the agency is in some of these activities. The second role that we have is working with businesses and reducing or eliminating, as I said, we would like to eliminate as a goal. And so we monitor the toxic release inventory, which is a federal law and it is also a state law for businesses to report on their generation. Unfortunately for us, getting the data is delayed a little bit. They report to Homeland Security, and then the data flows back through our public safety and then flows to us. So it can be more than a year late in some cases for us to know what's actually going on. We hope to be able to speed that out, but we're not quite there yet on it. So you'll see that we were more than 2 years late in the last years, and so we're at 2005, our generation numbers are. You will see that typically manufacturers and waste treatment are the two highest producers of chemical waste, and so we actually focus on those areas. They become our priority areas, and we're looking at specific targets. We're trying to work with the retired Engineers Association. They offer their services at a very low price out to industries to help them redesign and eliminate the need for some of the chemicals. And then again, MNTAP goes out with theirs. And so I just wanted to highlight a little bit of MNTAP. We, through a grant process, give MNTAP nearly $1 million a year now. Through our analysis with that, for every dollar we spend and do, we get $6 in return on the investment, on the amount of waste they reduce, energy reduced. And they, in turn, train interns, and they are able to use the U of M research areas to do this. So it really is a synergistic approach that we do this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to go back to the toxic release inventory. So the PCA in that case is regulating the chemicals or the toxic chemicals or measuring how many are released. Or could you describe that involvement a little bit more?
Sure. What happens with this inventory, this is actually self-reported data from the various components. So anybody who releases it either through the air may release it just through their processes and they're making it. They have to report how much they do. What we in turn use is that information coming back to put in our models, to look at when we're doing our air modeling and our air assessments on what we might expect and where we're seeing it, and then to work to reduce it. Through this, we really know whether it's benzene being released, for instance, as a highly toxic chemical and one that produces cancer, or is it some other kind of chemical that we haven't been aware of and focusing on. So we use the information then to guide our other programs. This is also a small fee generator. There is a fee associated with your release in an effort to encourage them to reduce it in that pay. It's not a significant revenue source for us. One of the other areas that we do work both with businesses and local municipalities is low impact design. This is our area to reduce the impact from stormwater runoff. And I wanted to highlight one of our cities that had actually used it in their industrial park. And we often think of changing the environment and how we do things as a cost, not a cost savings. In this case, they saved $250,000. They were actually able to use it then to close a budget gap because the city was developing the industrial park with it. So we have taken some of those examples, and we're developing now with the cities a statewide model for a conservation ordinance that they can use, and it can apply these techniques to it. With that, we're also doing some studies with the University of Minnesota to actually show the effectiveness of some of those, so that cities and businesses can take the tool and use it themselves and apply it and fit their situation to it, so it's not a one-size-fits-all. And so that's fairly new research, and it's looking hopeful on what they're doing right now, but we're just getting the results back for it. When I got back to the office earlier, I just had a little snippet someone had sent. So it's very new research.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just so excited about this stuff. On the low impact design, is it just reducing runoff as part of the low impact design, or trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, vehicle miles traveled, promoting efficiency in different ways, or is it?
It goes beyond the low impact design. Low impact design is what we use on the stormwater definition, and then we are still working with people on the business component, the green buildings. In fact, one of the changes that we have made into our strategic plan is we ourselves are beginning to try to model the way for the state. And so we've worked with Department of Admin. We lease most of our buildings, and so we've actually come up with a green lease to reduce carbon footprint, to reduce the energy component of that. So these same individuals in our agency that are skilled in this part match up with the green buildings and the energy reduction activities. And as you bring it up, one of the things that the agency is trying to do is our fleet management. We're required by federal law to actually report on our flex fuel as part of the Energy Act. And in that case, for many years, you were not allowed to use hybrids as a match to reduce. It was all about E85 versus other kinds of fuel. The federal government has now changed that, and we're able to increase our hybrid ratio in our fleets, and so we'll be moving more and more towards that. I hope someday there are the other sorts of fleet ideas that we can use, including when you're using solar power to start other things. I would think someday they will design the car with the solar power too. This goes in turn with our effort to reduce our overall miles traveled, and so we have that as well as part of our going. So it's not just about what we use for fuel.
Madam Chair, I just have a quick question. Do you know of the vehicles that are flex fuel, how often they use E85 as opposed to gasoline?
Madam Chair, members, we're about 50%.
Okay.
It will vary depending on our offices. If you're up in Duluth, there aren't many options in the northeast part of the state. If you're in the southern part of the state, they very regularly use it. We're able to, some offices in some months use 100%. So our goal is to be somewhere between the 50 and 100, as they have an executive order that says you shall do it. But sometimes they're not most convenient for them, and so people don't.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. I'm wondering if it's easy to track because you have state dispensing. Like, do we have tanks that the state owns that dispense fuel, or is there a pretty easy way to track?
It is fairly easy to track, but it's more because we actually have state purchasing cards.
Okay.
So that database tells us exactly what they purchased and where they purchased it. And we're moving to the state database, which will also provide us who purchased it and what we did. And that's also an accountability, so we only purchase fuel.
You're not allowed to use those cards to purchase food or anything else. It's only fuel. And so it's fairly easy to track and run the numbers.
The type of fuel.
Yes. Our next outcome is really to look at ecosystems and partnering with local governments for strategies to conserve water and report. We've actually been more successful working with the industries in this area because of MNTAP, and I'll show you the results of that. Conservation of water is really more of a focus of the Department of Natural Resources, and so we do it as a byproduct of some of the other activities we do. And again, that particular objective will change and modify a little bit to recognize DNR. But MNTAP has been successful. We have been able to increase citizen monitoring, and that is in large part to the additional monies that we were given in the biennium, and we were able then to provide more dollars for locals and advertise, and we really are getting citizens to participate. Again, water conserved by MNTAP, they have some full-time people and they have a number of interns, and what this is just showing is the availability of interns often will make a difference in both our waste reduction areas and industries, and also the water conserved, because they're actually working directly with those industries. One of the big targeted industries in recent years was ethanol. We asked for it, and we actually worked very closely with MNTAP to do some pilots. While they were looking at water conservation, they were also able to reduce energy needs in those plants. And so they've made a focused area on it. They've done some reports on it. They would like the industry to adopt more of those kinds of standards. And so we're looking at what we can do to encourage that. And then again, relatively older data, and we will provide the updated to do it, but from 1998 to 2004, we were actually able to increase citizen monitoring from and units of government from 13% to 40%. They actually do most of our monitoring efforts now. And that's good. Again, as you think about finding impairments and then doing TMDLs and doing the restoration, it's those locals who really need the connection all the way through the process to understand. In fact, now we're getting so much data from the volunteers and local governments, we actually added one staff person just to look at the data and make sure if quality control was there and to do it. And we consider that a success, actually. The next area wanted to move into was the air program. The air program and the environmental fee is funded almost completely by annual air fees. So the numbers that you see on here, the $22 million over the course of the biennium, is generated by annual air fees. They do not have permit application fees. And so as we move beyond just some of the permitting activities, this still does not cover the entire regulatory program, but it covers most of the permitting activities for the standard kinds of things. So when we're thinking about registration permits, there's a number of different types of air permits. This fee goes a long way to covering that cost.
I think it'd be good to have some exact numbers.
Yes, ma'am. So our goals in this area, again, that we meet all the environmental or health-related standards. In Minnesota, we do, except for lead. In lead in the last year, EPA reduced the lead standard, and now we have an area in Eagan, Dakota County, that is not meeting it. We had a lead smelter there, and that, we believe, is the main issue there, and so we are now working with them to remove it. That is only one area of the state that does not meet that. We meet all of our other health standards, but we're getting close on some of them as we change it. Again, our prevention, management, and cleanup areas. In air, of course, once it's released, it's very hard to clean up, so you need a very rigorous enforcement action to stop that before it happens.
Let's look at this chart as one of the ways we're trying to get a handle on what how you're spending your money. You have how much you're spending on prevention in air, how much you're spending on management air, and how much you're spending on cleanup in air?
We could do that, yes.
Perhaps that would be one of the ways that we could see, because that's what we're having difficulty doing here, is tying the monies that were allocated to the results that we've gotten. That's not a result, that's an interim step. The result is clean air. But perhaps that... Would that be helpful, Mr. Reinholz?
Yes, I would. I mean, in the committee trying to make decisions based on results, you need to have information on exactly the dollars being spent for the various activities. A little closer tie here than it's being here.
Okay, would this be a good way to do it? To do it by these categories, then?
Yeah, I'm sure that certainly would be a piece of information that would be useful to you.
I mean, I see you have these components broken down, like for water, too. So if we could see that, that would be... We're going to need to be getting this information out to committee members, hopefully by next week, as you present.
If I could, Madam Chair, just to add on to that a little bit, that it seems too that having a dollar sign, but how many FTEs are going along with it and that kind of a thing?
Yes, the FTEs are in the budget, but I will redo it and show it in this format: prevention, FTEs, and dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that, I don't want to speak out of turn, but that we like to see ubiquitous throughout,
yes,
in the presentation.
Yes, sir. Again, looking at trends, and our air report just came out, and so I wasn't able to do that. It actually came out this week, and so I will need to get the updated trend lines for you. What you will see when we do the trend lines, what we have done differently in our new air report is actually show you the air quality days, the days of alert, along with some of the trends here. And what you will find is that when ozone and the PM2.5 go up, and so do our days of issues with the air quality. And so there is some relationship to some of those. As you might imagine, that is why we have standards with them, and they relook at those standards. Ozone is particularly one that we stay, we bounce up close to the standard periodically.
Okay.
This is just an observation that, or a question, I don't know if you can answer the question, but if we were to adopt the clean car standard, that would reduce the level of pollutants from motor vehicles that cause smog, right?
Madam Chair, yes.
Would it help us meet our goals?
It would not hurt. The other And I'm using that based on what our staff has put in as part, potentially some of the strategies that would help us. Because as we look at this, we're also trying to reduce, if I go just back a step, one of the things we're trying to reduce is the nitrogen dioxide from the 2002 levels by 2012 by 30%. We're pretty comfortable that we will do that with nitrogen dioxide. We're not as comfortable, that same kind of goal exists for sulfur dioxide, and we're not as comfortable there. And so we will need to be fairly aggressive in how we look at some of these to do. And those are the precursors often you'll hear about to PM 2.5. And so it's important that they are reduced.
I've got a great film.
Well, by statute, CO2 is a pollutant, but you don't carry that on this chart?
We don't monitor for that, ma'am. What these are the six, what we call the six criteria pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And so that is under the federal program what we monitor for. So we don't, at this time, have monitors out for CO2.
Madam Chair, on that point, there was a Supreme Court case decided on April 2nd, 2007, that where the EPA wasn't considering carbon dioxide as an air pollutant, and so they weren't requiring tracking and prevention under the Clean Air Act. So I don't know if any states were doing it, maybe one. But then after that decision came down, the Bush EPA didn't do anything about the Supreme Court decision. But my understanding is that the new EPA administrator is looking at actually implementing that Supreme Court case. So we're sort of with the national group. I mean, we're tracking the pollutants that have traditionally been tracked under the Clean Air Act, but there's a whole set of new pollutants that might now be regulated under the Clean Air Act. But we haven't really gotten any guidance from EPA on it yet. They kind of didn't do anything for a year and a half.
We have a state statute, though, that says CO2 is a pollutant. So I think it's the state statute that I was talking about.
Madam Chair, on this point, because I might have a bill where we have a registry of greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide being the main one. Is it possible to, I mean, carbon dioxide is a global pollutant, whereas these are more regional pollutants, and so has the PCA done work towards how we would monitor, because it does have a different impact?
And Chair members, we actually have to go back and talk to Rick Strassman, our supervisor on it. He does think about all of these things, and monitoring and improving our monitoring capability and changing where our monitors are so we have earlier warning systems on the air quality index. And so he'd be the best one for me to check and report back to the committee on that status.
I think Peter Sabarowski from the PCA did a greenhouse gas inventory for the MCAG group. So we are obviously doing some sort of tracking, because we have a substantial report called the Greenhouse Gas Inventory that provides our baseline for Next Generation Energy Act.
Madam Chair, members, we actually have made those estimates with Peter, and he is our expert, but we don't really monitor for it. So I was trying to differentiate between those. To do, and so that's the part that I'm trying to link up for you. So you're right, we have Peter, who has studied this thoroughly and is an expert actually in his field. The other point I want to make is, while we do have those air quality index days, one of the important things is to make sure that the data is accurate when we do that, because we actually contract with a group who does the modeling and projects the days and tries to tell us what's happening. We then go back, and based on what they have modeled and what they told, we try to check and verify how accurate that data is. Because as we know we don't want to be causing unnecessary concern when we're telling people not to do something, nor do we want to misinform them the other way and miss a day when someone should be curtailing their activities on a particular day. This slide shows you again kind of what our goals are in trying to meet by 2011 and 2018 the reductions. We are going to need, as you can see on here, by 2012, we don't think we'll be in our below the line. It really is going to take for SO2 to be quite aggressive in what we're doing.
I'm sorry, just to take you back two slides on that sulfur dioxide, it looks like we had a real spike from 2002 to 2005. Do you know what that's attributable to?
No, I don't. But I will ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to the slide we were on, looking at the sulfur dioxide and the goal, I know that the Twin Cities and Minnesota in general is an attainment. So is that goal attainment of federal air quality standards, or is it a Minnesota goal? And if we aren't in attainment, what does that mean, particularly for our state budget, what it might cost us?
That goal is actually our goal to reduce. We are in attainment, but we believe we need to make further, more aggressive reductions in it in order to impact the PM 2.5 and ozone areas. And so by reducing these, you, particularly NOx, you impact ozone. By reducing NOx and the sulfur dioxide, you impact 2.5. So we need to do these in order to help our 2.5. But we are in total attainment for the area.
Madam Chair and Ms. Halbach, are we close to not being in attainment? Is there concern? Because I know my understanding is it's a couple hundred million dollars if we go into non-attainment in our budget. So I just want to make sure that we're not getting close to that point.
Madam Chair, members, we are close on ozone. The federal government recently reduced the ozone threshold from 0.08 to 0.075. And so that just moves us that much closer, and so we do want to be aggressive and make sure we don't go over. And $200 million is the number that I've heard staff talk about. Part of the way that we do manage and control these things is through our air permitting, and we need to keep those current and up to date. And you can see for our major air permits, which these would be called in the federal vernacular the Part 70 air permits. So these are individual, therefore are more complicated, larger emitters. And we were behind for a number of years. In fact, we were far behind the federal goal for us to get completed. We now have all the Part 70s issued, and we're into the reissuance of permits. So the change you see in the 2006, 2007 in getting caught up is actually one of our Six Sigma projects where we focused on what we were doing in the air permits. And the two main factors we did were we worked with permittees and actually got better applications in the door, so the data was better, more complete. And then we actually focused our staff time a little bit differently, so they were able to focus on one project and get it complete. And so it really did make a difference in how timely they could get those permits done. One of our other objectives is, of course, continuing to look at those toxics and air pollutants, making sure that we're meeting the standards. And through this one, when we do enforcement, we actually try to measure the emissions we've recovered or stopped, prevent it from happening. And right now we do a total estimate. One of our goals will be to actually look at which emissions we're doing. So was it a NOx emission? Was it a CO2? Was it VOCs? What exactly did we stop and prevent? You will see in some cases, in some quarters, there have been no emissions due to the enforcement. We actually counted in the year we settle it issue. And so it really is dependent on when your enforcement actions go through, on when you will see it. Also, enforcement actions sometimes are not about the actual emissions. They're about, are they missing reports coming in? Did they not do some of their follow-up mechanical work? And so it's not always about emissions. This is something relatively new that we've been doing in all of our enforcement cases, trying to find what actually we have stopped. And then we're trying to put, if we can put some benefit to that. EPA has a process to do. Our folks are not quite ready to make the estimates that EPA does because we think there are a lot more guesstimates than true estimates. And so this is a developing area for us to actually put and quantify the pollutants that we've stopped through our enforcement actions.
I think I'm having difficulty reading this. So in 2006, you stopped a lot. In 2007, you stopped less. And in 2008, you barely stopped any at all.
Madam Chair, as I said, it depends on when the enforcement actions are completed, when we actually count the emissions. And you have to be able, we don't make estimates of every enforcement. We actually have to be able to try to quantify some activity with it. So there won't be, on every enforcement case, a pollutant associated with it.
But why is it dropping like this?
It's merely a fact of when our inspectors are out there, what sorts of activities are they seeing at the facilities? If you have facilities actually 95% compliant, which is we're in the 90 to 95%, you would expect the amount of pollutant to get to reduce. We were much more active in our staff testing and evaluation of that so that folks made adjustments with that. So the goal of our is actually to be in compliance and not to have large numbers on the enforcement side. They should be relatively low if we're running a good overall program.
Do you have a question, Representative
Gunther? You know, I've been told by several people that the amount of oxygen that we breathe for our health and life is depleting and decreasing year by year. Is that true?
Madam Chair, members, I don't know the answer to that question.
It should be one of the things that I would think the MPC would monitor since it's so important to life.
Could you text me?
That would be nice to know.
Our next goal is really about looking at our regional, national, and global contributions. And two particular areas for this are the mercury emissions and then what we're up at our national parks in northern Minnesota and reducing the visibility impairments up there. And so for mercury sources, by 2006, we were nearly at the original goal we set in reducing this. Then we had the TMDL come through, and our new goal for mercury is 789 pounds. So there's a lot more work to do. And that actual goal of 789 pounds to be the maximum release was the number generated by a stakeholder process that included industry, environmental, And so it was a year-long process where everybody looked at what they could do, and they broke out the expectations by sector. So they actually have a goal for the power industry, for the mining industry, in trying to reduce that.
Just under perception.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hallbach, I hesitate to go backwards here, but I need to go back to that slide that we were talking. I can't read that number. The one with the air emissions recovered, the graph. Yeah, and does that not include that? It's unclear to me. The answer that we heard here is, does that not include emissions that were prevented due to permits?
That is correct, sir. We have not yet done that.
Okay, that doesn't make sense, but I would offer to you that that's part of enforcement, and that those graphs would make more sense if you included the totality of what enforcement is actually keeping out, or what's not escaping or is polluting.
Madam Chair, members, we think of permitting on the prevention side. And so we can talk about that, but we are beginning to do just as you say. Our wastewater group is a little farther ahead. They're trying to, what would they do, what have we done, and what have we prevented from the permitting process to do. So those are very good comments that we are doing. And it would look completely different.
Representative Stout, you have a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I had a question regarding, and because we're talking about mercury, the slide that you were on, and this, my question is not regarding mercury in air, but mercury in the dental use, and that's coming up in the water programs. And since we're now requiring separation of the amalgam, I'm wondering, are there a number of amalgam separators on the market, and do some work better than others, and how are we doing with that problem?
Madam Chair, members, I actually have our hazardous waste folks give me that information. They've worked very closely with it. So we'll report back to you on that.
Thank you. And then as a follow-up, maybe have them report back as well. Do they all reduce mercury in the same fashion, and or is the market open to all manufacturers of those separators?
Okay.
Thank you.
This I wanted to show you is our goals for regional haze, and we just completed this goal. And to set these goals up, we need approval from EPA, so it's a fairly intensive project to do. And the data is, there's actually too little data to tell the trends on it. So I do this to show that we are watching for those important ones. And the reduction areas here will most likely be at the mining industry and some of the power industry up there. But the mining particularly are looking, as those most recent ones were permitted, they were permitted with some technologies that should do the reduction and that they're testing out that would become probably technology used across the U.S. at the mining industry. And so this was very progressive. We worked with, actually, in this case, we need to work with the land managers of the federal government who really watch over these national parks, and they agreed with this goal as well. As we approach our water programs, again in here, in this case, the general fund went up because we had the one-time $31 million during the biennium for the Clean Water Legacy Act efforts. And so that was a big focus for our area. And because we will be talking about clean water funding and that very detailed with the 10 and 11, I did not put a lot of that into this presentation, Madam Chair. because I knew we would be going very in-depth and we would have to talk about what we did and what we intend to do with that presentation. So I've tended to focus on something different in this presentation. One area that we recognize of significant need is our groundwater and surface water. You will see that we have more data and more staffing area in the ground, in the surface water. So we are still in a place where we need to focus in on the groundwater, working with our sister agencies on that. We have a memorandum of agreement on how we're going to approach it. But we did not achieve in this biennium what we thought we did. One of the important factors would have been getting an LCCMR project, and we were not successful in that. So we're regrouping to see how we can do this in shifting dollars around within our program.
What program from LCCMR did you not receive money for?
There was a joint agency one for groundwater monitoring and to install some wells and to upgrade and move forward the groundwater program, much the same way that we were fortunate to do the surface water monitoring, that we would be able to boost and get those in. Again, there are a lot of projects in it. We didn't get it this year, and so we're relooking with the sister agencies on how to do that. So we're not giving up. We're just a little behind what we anticipated we would be. And again, following your earlier thought, we will try to do the budget in giving you these areas. One of the items in the groundwater system, though, is with the other agencies to produce one of the basic foundations of it was to produce a report on the condition of the groundwater and where we are in doing that. That report was done. It's fairly thick, but it does provide us a approach going forward in how we want to proceed with monitoring. So it did analyze essentially where we were in general, groundwater quality being good, urban areas having impacts, and so then again, we would need to focus in on that. Typically, we do groundwater monitoring along where we already have wells. And so those might be at landfills. They might be with municipalities. And our goal is to install some very strategic ones so that we can really make across the state an analysis of where it is in our condition. We're all pretty well aware of the elevated nitrate concentrations that exist in our rural or the unsewered areas, and that's why there is a focus on unsewered areas and getting them sewered and improved. And so we really want to install some additional wells to get that spatial coverage and know the impact.
When Dakota County did there, it's the only county we have that's done really good work in groundwater. When they found nitrates in their groundwater, they said there was 100% correlation with finding pesticides. Did you find that?
I don't know the answer to that. We will report out because we do have the reports. And as well, our groundwater manager will be here with us next week because she also does the surface monitoring. And so she'll be able to talk in much better detail than I am.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to do it again. Can you back up a couple slides to the pie chart on water? There you go. I can't read. For that federal share, $16 million, do you prepare a work plan that has outcomes in it then for the federal government, for EPA? I assume that's where that comes from, to conform with GIPA?
We do a work plan with them. We have entered with them. The way they approach it is they have an environmental agreement with us, and mm-hmm. so we do joint where we propose what we're going to do and they look at it and see whether it meets, but all of our programs that receive federal money have under what we call our EMPA, so our agreement with them. It comes in a chunk and allows us a little bit of flexibility that way, so it's much like our multimedia. So we get this agreement. They look at it. They come in and do them program reviews of it. So did we meet our objectives? We have to report to them as well. They do the financial audit, and they do a program audit with us. And it will depend on which program, how often they do it.
What I'm curious about is excuse me, Madam Chair, what I'm curious about is what kind of objectives or outcomes or results as per the Government Performance Results Act that you have to provide to the EPA. I know that can be fairly rigorous from some of my experience, but is that information, could that be made available to us?
Absolutely, we can.
What do you provide?
We have both our partnership agreement, and we have the every 2 year the assessment that we do with them.
Madam Chair, what I'm interested in is the work plan and the outcomes that you or the results that you associate strategically with the work.
Madam Chair, members, our partnership agreement contains the work plan, and so that's negotiated with them. And then at the end of the cycle, there's an assessment, so how we did it. And so that is also, we do a draft of that. They edit it, and then we finalize it. We're in the midst of finalizing our last one right now with that. So that should be final soon, and we would be able to provide that to you.
And Madam Chair, I just believe that may provide some help for myself anyway, and perhaps to the committee on how we move forward with outcomes from your agency overall. Thanks.
So our goal three is really our chemical, physical, and biological integrity issue, and improving the number of assessments we do on the streams and rivers by 2015 to 33% compared to 2003 to 5% level. Then we also have a focus on wetlands, and it's important to us to look at these wetlands. To do our stream assessment, as you can see, originally what we were able to do in the watershed through our funding, LCCMR boosted us and gave us the money so we could increase that. And then the citizen local monitoring that helps with us now through the Clean Water Legacy Act for the biennium did another increase. And so we really have increased and are on our way to meeting that target. From the wetland quality survey, we do this in conjunction with our partners at Department of Natural Resources. This is fairly recent, we're moving off of. In the green, you'll see some dots in there. Maybe you'll see them, they don't look clear from here. But there are a number of sites that are actually located in the green. Those are the places we monitored in 2007. We're now creating and we don't have the map that we did do in 2008, but so far there have been about 300 wetlands that have been sampled, and we're creating a tool to look at the biological assessment. This is a process that EPA has approved with us and have actually given us a grant to be doing. It's fairly new in wetlands, and the idea is then we will be able to randomly sample 65 wetlands in one of the three ecoregions every year. And what we're doing with DNR is we're actually flying over and doing aerial plots so that we can look at the change in three-year rotations in the wetlands, and particularly as we have the no net loss. Then we're going in and sampling those to determine their status, and then from there we'll figure out the quality of them. And so this is really a very unique area that EPA funded, and is funded through part of 2009 calendar year. So it'll end in October. We will be looking at how we arrange our funds. It's a three-year program. EPA funded us for 2 years. And so we will be making those adjustments to do it.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I have a question. I'm assuming you're monitoring for impaired waters in these wetlands. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, no. This is not associated with the impaired waters. At some point, we will wrestle with how to bring wetlands into the impaired waters area. This right now is just really looking at the health of those wetlands from an ecosystem perspective. And so that's why it's mainly focused right now on the biological to do that. And then as we really know about it and have a tool that way, then we might be able to tell really are they impaired or not. But we have no kind of baseline to really estimate that on. And that's why EPA was interested in this. This is really developing the tool.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I was just kind of curious because there's a number of water bodies and wetlands that have been tested by PCA, and some have been, I think 40% have been found to be impaired. Where does that fit in this slideshow?
So 40% would be roughly our streams and lakes. We haven't put, unless the wetland is directly connected to the lake or been in between two lakes that are connected and we're putting those on, the wetlands really have not been put on the impaired waters list. And that historically has been a very difficult place in the federal law on how you would do that. And so when we develop that list right now, there's concern that if you did it and don't have a good measurement, every wetland, because that is the nature of a wetland, is to provide a sink for phosphorus and a sink for other things, that they themselves would not meet water quality standards. And so that's why we're looking at a biological kind of health and being able to treat that to really define what the health of a particular wetland should be in the ecosystem. And until we have that, we really can't go much farther on the impaired.
And I guess what I'm getting at, and maybe it'll come up in the future slides then, is would be for shallow lakes, the ones that have been tested and found to be impaired. And my where I'm heading is that I'm wondering what would happen if the PCA tests a shallow lake and discovers that it's been used for intensive concentrated fish farming through which somebody had a permit from the DNR, and that water then becomes degraded because of bottom feeding fish. Then how does the PCA handle that as we're going forward with using a money that's going to be started to be collected on July 1st? If we find a degraded or impaired wetland or shallow lake because of intensive fish farming, how would you handle that?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, members, I couldn't give you an absolute on that, but if you're going through the TMDL process and it is listed as impaired, then we would create a TMDL report on that. That would actually say, here's what it needs to be brought back to, and here's some options. So if we knew it was from the fish farming, and we knew it might be from what's remaining in there, the resolution to that would be perhaps removing that sediment and re-aerating to do that. Now, I know that the next question probably entering your mind is, who would pay for that? And that I really can't tell, because I think that is what we have to do through the whole TMDL process, is figure out who would be responsible in that.
Just quickly here, thank you, Madam Chair. I heard you talk about the ecological based approach for wetlands. do you envision doing that with regular lake ecosystems?
Oh, you're on to my next slide. The answer is yes.
Okay, I'll wait and hear your slide.
And you will hear more about it next week because it's an important part for the entire program. One of the questions that the chair and I talked back and forth as we were trying to think about this presentation was biological monitoring and the health of it. And so I did have, and again, the experts will be here next week, so they'll be able to do more intensive. But we do biological monitoring. And this map is intended to show you what we did in 2008 and what we intend to do in 2009. And it's not us alone. When we look at biological, we need to work with the Department of Natural Resources. And relative to the lake question, we don't know what the proper biological indicator is. For streams and creeks, we do know that E. coli gives us a lot of information to then search farther. And when we find those issues, our next step and why we still do chemical and physical is once you know it's impaired for the aquatic life and that, then you need to know why. And so the chemical and the physical often give us indications with it. And so you'll see that for, on the next slide is an example where in the Snake River, we start out at a very high random level, 58 kind of things where we do the biological monitoring, go in, determine aquatic life. Then we do a smaller sampling where we do the biology and the chemical to do. And then we further look at looking at kind of what we're doing for the aquatic recreation and that. And that's really more of a watershed kind of base. But DNR is still working with us to find the right thing for lakes and streams that tell us about the health of the aquatic. And of course, one we're looking at truly recreational use when you think about lakes and being able to do that. And on the rivers, you're more directly contact.
I just would offer as an observation that perhaps if you thought about how you designate your uses, that would lead you to that. If you said that a lake was going to be a walleye whitefish fishery, for instance, instead of a recreation, you would have an ecological base for a designated use that may help lead you to where you need a food chain to support the walleye whitefish, etc. And those are fairly well defined. We know that food chain. So, just
Madam Chair, members, we're actually looking at that sort of. We're undertaking a big rule right now to look at how we do it. It's called tiered aquatic life, and we are looking at changing the way we look at it based on the aquatic use of the stream.
Madam Chair, miracles never cease.
And again, you'll hear more about this, so I'll move through this slide quickly, but as the Clean Water Legacy Act set up is that we look at the major watersheds on a 10-year cycle. We are on pace to do that. And what this shows is really the One Water program that we're trying to do, that we do all of everything on that same 10-year cycle. So you first move through doing the assessment, creating the TMDLs, restoring it, and then you do the effectiveness monitoring after that to make sure that what you're trying on the land is actually producing the water results that you intended. Of course, when we move to a watershed framework, there are pros and cons, and we'll talk in detail about it, but we think the pros do outweigh it. This doesn't mean that every watershed and that we're dispersed equally across the state, but we do have a plan. The order that we would do them in is available. The staff have been looking at a draft plan that way and have been talking out to Farm Bureau and other places so they could see that plan and give us comments back. So we're taking it out for them to look at. We hope in this same method to to have our permitting follow it as well, and so that it really structures the way we approach our water program. Our next area is on septic tanks and characterizing them as failing and imminent threats to public health, and moving them from 39% to 5% by 2014. And then we are also looking at making sure that our wastewater plants, again, are permitted timely and are in compliance.
On the members on the septic tanks characterized as failing or imminent threats to public health, we put some money into that in our budget last year, so that is one of the things that I think I want us to see, not the 2006, but what happened in 2007.
And I tried to do that before I came back tonight, and the staff weren't around, so we will get that information for you. We will change this also from the percentages to actual numbers so you can see what's happening. This one shows actually the what we're trying to do from pollutant reduction to wastewater treatment. In this case, the line going up is a good thing. The base level is that they have 85% removal. And you'll see that increasingly we have moved up the removal rate, and that is because we're moving to what's called tertiary or advanced treatment options. So we have more facilities doing that. Phosphorus requires that. Some of our plants have nitrogen removal. That requires at that level. And we actually see that continuing as we look at TMDLs and know the impairments that more plants will have to do improved treatment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on this, on our wastewater treatment, what kind of discussions have you had, or are you moving towards dealing with emerging contaminants and endocrine disruptors and some of the things that we haven't always traditionally thought of our wastewater taking care of, but I'm more and more convinced that that's one of the places we need to be taking care of it. Yeah, pharmaceuticals, things like caffeine, things that are passing through people and ending up in our water system, and our wastewater treatments that is currently designed aren't really taking care of them.
I do know our staff are having that discussion. They're still also focused on getting the basic communities getting secondary treatment and not having straight discharges. They're also looking at, for some of our rural communities that are small, could they afford the cost of operating if you moved into that? And so I think there are a lot of parts of that discussion that they're working on. How far they've gone, I think we have to have them actually here to talk to the committee. And again, you would expect if you're having higher treatment that the discharges would see less of BOD, phosphorus, ammonia. Naturally flows from one to the other.
Representative Dunfer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have small towns that you pointed out that have sewage treatment problems. You have five individuals that were picked by popularity and so forth, not because of their expertise in determining what kind of sewage treatment plant they should have, but yet the MPCA and the Public Facilities Administration assume that they know how and have all the expertise needed to pick those out. Can you show me or tell me about some program that the MPCA has in giving these small communities with these five normal people help?
Madam Chair, the Public Utilities right now has some technical assistance to theirs. Our staff, whether they're the permit staff or the engineer or even the compliance staff, try to work very closely with those cities. They can't dictate to them what they do, but they do try. I used to be a Southwest regional manager and tried to work very closely with those cities so that they provided the right technology at the right cost for them. Under the Rural Development Authority, when they're getting grants out of there, we actually are allowed to compare treatment options and provide a real economic analysis as well as the technical, but typically we're only allowed to give the technical advice on whether this selected option they do meets the standards. So we try to be proactive via city council. We've in the past given guidance on how to hire a consultant to make sure. We've guided people to go to other cities of that size and make sure that the adjustment is there. We do try it. We're not always as successful, I think, as we might like, but we don't have control to dictate to them.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've had three communities in my district that have had tremendous problems in getting the solutions, picking the right person, the engineering firm. In fact, two of them got sand filtered systems that had to be completely redone at double the cost to the state. And Mr. Sherman and I both agree that it costs way too much. And I think that we should establish a policy within the department that they don't have any choice. They have to take your expertise so they won't pick a sand filtered system when a ponding system is much more cost effective than everything else. So if you can get back to me any efforts that you could propose that I make a law based on, because the little town of Louisville, Minnesota spent over $3 million in the sewage treatment plant because they had to do it twice. And if you could easily sue an engineering firm, I'll guarantee you that firm wouldn't have a dime today. Because I think it's a disaster, and I think the agencies and state governments should be ashamed of themselves for not doing the right thing for small people that might be farmers, might be retired gas station operators, might be small engine repairmen. Those are all happen to be occupations of these people in Louisville. They didn't have a clue. They said they never got a bit of help from anybody.
I think that's a good discussion for us to have.
I do too.
At some point.
I would appreciate that.
Let's not forget that one, because it is also this question of reinventing the wheel again and again and again and again. You want to continue?
By the way, Madam Chairman, that's about three times more than the whole community's worth.
That too. So we want to finish up here because folks need to get out of here.
I am nearly complete. The next slides will go, I think, rather quickly. This is our multimedia budget. And the sorts of things, again, that we do in here are those that cross air, water, solid waste at the same time. It is where a lot of our monitoring activities come. It is also where we do data. The assistance. So you heard this morning about our environmental data access. That sort of system is managed out of here. And we have, and so we, for this part of it, you will see that the outcomes in that don't reflect the same way that you saw the others. But I wanted to show you one example, which is where we look at our enforcement activities. Again, enforcement can cover more than one area, and we do have, you might think about this, but we try to get our enforcement actions done in a reasonable time frame after we find the problem. That has not always been the case, and in this case, this is our administrative penalty order. And the idea of those was that we give due process, but we do it quickly, that we go through it. They're to be resolved within 30 days if this is the right penalty tool. The penalty is not greater than $10,000, so we need to move those through the system. Much like our other areas, we are trying to do Six Sigma kinds of projects, so continuous improvement to bring down the timeline. We still have Those who take a long time take way too long. You will see that in the green line. The trend is moving downward, and that's what we want. We want to be able to find them, move through it, get the correction out there. Because while this is often maybe lingering, the solution is not always going on at the same time. And so if it's taking a while to get this out so we get the correction, we have problems going on at the site.
Can you tell me the y-axis there? I can't see it. I can't read it up here or anything.
It's percent. It's the total number, essentially the timeliness, how many percent of those APOs we did were done in a timely fashion for us.
All right.
And it's from the day we find it till it's closed out, so that means they've told us they've corrected the proposal. The other area that's done in our multimedia is our environmental review area. And so in the last 2 years, we have done 27 feedlots, 14 wastewater treatment facilities, 2007-2008. 6 ethanol plants, 3 landfills. You'll see that in fiscal year 08, we had a drop in them. That reflects economic development. We're still seeing right now a little bit of drop. Some things are coming back. These same people deal with when we have accumulative effects and impacts. They look at what the court has said we need to investigate on those areas. They also look at kind of the modeling and monitoring and bring that back down to a project level and how we evaluate it. And I know on Thursday, Madam Chair, there's going to be a discussion about the process. So I just did this one slide so you know that multimedia covers this area. And then quickly, we have our administrative support programs. We do not currently have good outcomes for that. The sorts of things our administrative program does are what you might imagine being support functions in an agency to do. The one area that we do have some measurements is our information system. And one of those areas that we focus and continue to focus on is the security around those information systems. So how easy is it for you to break into our computer network? How are we managing the spam and doing that? And you can see at times the low-level issues we're managing quite well. As most of the state agencies, the management of those very sophisticated security systems were not as well as we should be. And with that, I end my...
Thank you, Madam Chair. For one last question, we've run into a lot of Office of Legislative Auditor reports on different agencies and different problems with financial controls, and I'm just curious how many internal auditors you have or what kind of controls you have on your internal controls on your financial system.
Madam Chair, members, we have no official auditors. But for instance, when staff use our purchasing card, we do have a staff who looks at those, pulls them, ask questions. And in fact, last summer, we had enough questions about it. We re-looked at it at the senior management level. We created some new policies and activities that are just going into place for this. On that basis, we have changed what the level that staff are able to use the card for, what they may purchase it, what temporary employees may use it for, that we're looking at only putting at hotels. But we do our monitoring during the summer. That's often with temporary or seasonal help, but they're often far away from having resources right next to them, so they sometimes have to purchase. If you're doing electric shocking, as I'm reminded by the supervisor, if you tear a leak in the gaiter, you can't continue to do that. You need to get a new gaiter and new hip waders and make sure that you're dry inside. And so, but we put more controls on that. We have been talking about how to improve some of our other controls. We do have separation of duties. We do have some of that. But we have been paying attention, and we are taking those matters to heart in what we do with our system.
Representative Dunster, did you have the last question?
No.
Representative Hortman.
I just had a comment. I know Assistant Commissioner Schirkenbach is that my thing, right? It stuck with us through the night. I just wanted to say that he used a phrase at one of the beverage container stakeholder meetings that I think it gets at the heart of what we're trying to do with this outcome-based budgeting. He said, we don't want to be busy, we want to be effective. And I think that this presentation has kind of barely scratched the surface of some of the really phenomenal work that's happening. You know, from the meetings I've been to in the beverage container stakeholder group, they've got a solid waste stakeholder group. There's all sorts of things. There's really a phenomenal solid waste policy report that the PCA just put out. So I think this scratches the surface, but I thought that was a phrase that we would want to come back to as we look at other parts of our state government, but in PCA too, is we don't want anybody to be busy. We want to be effective.
We want to be able to tell citizens what they want for their money.
Exactly. Well, with that, thank you for sticking with us through this evening, and we will, I think, be seeing you a week from today. Is that correct?
Thank you.
With that, meeting's adjourned.